I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 19th, 2024. We do have a quorum. First item on the agenda is the minutes from March 15th. Representative Finke, will you move the minutes of March 15th?
Madam Chair, I move the
minutes. All right. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a very full agenda, so all the testifiers have been told how much time they have, and hopefully we're going to have a productive day. Welcome, Representative Bierman. You are first up. I will move to refer House File 4853 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing House File 4853. We will focus on the issues pertaining to judiciary, but a little explainer about the bill will be helpful. HMOs were invented in Minnesota in 1973. The pledge of the nonprofit HMO has always been to exist as a charitable organization for the healthcare benefit of Minnesotans. These entities and how we regulate them in a complex and evolving healthcare marketplace have clear financial implications for our citizens. This bill addresses the issue of conversions of nonprofit health maintenance organizations. A conversion is the transfer of all or a substantial portion of a nonprofit health maintenance organization business or assets to a for-profit entity. Conversions in other states, unprepared for such transitions, saw charitable assets removed from public benefit after years of public investment, making millions of dollars for the executives and doing little for the people in their states. This bill creates robust safeguards around conversions for the public interest, including a transparent public process, a full and fair market value assessment of the public benefit assets to be preserved for the public good. The bill also assigns the Attorney General as the current protector of charitable assets in Minnesota presently to ensure that these public assets from conversions are utilized as designated to advance the future healthcare interests of Minnesotans. The Minnesota Department of Health is the regulator of Minnesota's HMOs, but they receive far less information and oversight than the Department of Commerce has over health insurers. This bill updates the sight lines to regulate both nonprofit and the new for-profit HMOs allowed to operate in Minnesota since 2017. The articles that pertain to this committee's jurisdiction, Article 1 takes a small subset of the existing statutes, those that govern financial transaction reporting for insurers, and says that HMOs are also subject to them. Article 1, Subdivision 1A, is regards to confidentiality. Under current law, these data are classified as non-public for insurers, and the same classification would now apply to transactions involving HMOs. Article 1, Subdivision 1A also. Subdivision 7 speaks to the jurisdiction of Minnesota courts with regard to violations of this section of statute. Article 2, Section 5, Subdivision 2. The AG already can pursue equitable relief if an entity violates Minnesota nonprofit or antitrust laws. This section adds to the ability to sue if a transaction violates public interest. It also, this section, allows MDH to share non-public information with the AGO to aid in their investigation of conversion transactions, with a requirement that AGO maintains the data with the same classifications. And Article 2, Section 5, Subdivision 3, MDH can share data with the AGO consistent with the terms of the DPA, the Data Practices Act. Article 2, Section 6, data provided by HMOs is classified as AGO data under the DPA. So, Madam Chair, this is it in a nutshell. I do not have any testifiers today, but I do have I can take questions, and if I need some help, we have the Attorney General's office and the Minnesota Department of Health here to go take a deeper dive.
Hopefully not. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. All right. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this bill. I think it's needed. I used to serve as general counsel to Metropolitan Health Plan, Hennepin County Safety Net Health Plan, and I took pride when I went to national conferences that we are the only state that required health plans to be nonprofit. I was shocked and disappointed when the law was changed, so thank you for doing this.
All right. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman. I'm curious about the language about the Attorney General's powers referenced on line 8.25, saying that the Attorney General has the powers in section 8.31. I don't see anything in here that references the private right of action in subdivision 3A. Am I missing that? And is there some language here that deals with the reference to a private right of action in 8.31 subdivision 3A?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I think I'll ask the AG's office to come down and respond to that, and we'll have them weigh in here. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representatives. I'm Erin Conti. I'm with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Madam Chair and Representative Niska, there's not a provision about a private right of action within the remedies section in Article 2. It talks about that the Attorney General may bring suit to pursue equitable remedies, and it adds as a cause of action within that we may sue if a transaction is not within the public interest.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer, Ms. Conti. I guess I'm still concerned about to what degree 8.31 is being, or this statute is being brought within the scope of 8.31, because as you know, 8.31 has in subdivision 3A a sort of broad private right of action that applies to anything that any statute that comes within the scope of 8.31 subdivision 1. And so I'm just trying to understand whether that's sort of an intended consequence of this bill, that this is creating some sort of new 8.31 subdivision 3A private potential for private suits, or whether whether I'm misunderstanding the reference to 8.31 here.
Understood. Madam Chair.
Yep.
Discuss.
Go ahead.
Apologies. So it is not intended to create a new private right of action. 8.31 is, as you know, very frequently thrown in as kind of a catch-all for the Attorney General's powers to get a CID if additional follow-up is, or issue a CID if civil investigative demand, if additional information is needed, and to kind of pursue, use those other basic investigative tools. That's the reason for the citation.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer. I guess I'm very concerned then about the way this sentence reads on 8.25. The Attorney General has the powers in Section 8.31. It seems to be either that means nothing and 8.31 already applies to all of this stuff, or this seems to be sort of expressing our sense as the legislature that this new provision that we're creating is something that falls within 8.31 subdivision 1. And 8.31 subdivision 1, if a law, any law, any deceptive or, any of the many different consumer fraud or consumer protection statutes that are referenced in 8.31 subdivision 1, in 8.31 subdivision 3A, there is a explicit private right of action that references anything that's within the scope of 8.31 subdivision 1. So either this sentence is unnecessary, or we are creating a new private right of action, unless there's some clarifying language added to it. So I hope that will be taken care of. If you have comments on that, I do have some other questions as well about the bill.
Representative Niska, this was already in Commerce. I know we had a chance to talk about it there. Are you intending to create a separate right of action?
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, no. And The reason this language is there is it's carrying over the Attorney General's obligations to protect nonprofit assets. Those are already established and codified in other spaces in law. We did not want to create ambiguity around these conversion transactions. We are trying to ensure that the existing processes are still respected while these additional sightlines are being provided to the commissioners.
Anything else, Representative Niska?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, this is the committee where we deal with private right, private causes of action. I think that there's some. I guess I missed the amendment deadline to fix this problem. But I do hope that the author and the Attorney General's office will take another look at. How this language is drafted and what the implications of it are if a private right of action is not intended. I guess I'm just curious more generally what the purpose of this bill is and how it interacts with our legalization of for-profit HMOs. Is this just a way to kind of chip away at that, Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman, and remember this is going to health next, so there is time for you to come up with an amendment. Representative Bierman.
Thank you. First off, this bill assumes that the nonprofit and for-profit will coexist in the state of Minnesota as it is right now. So this is assuming that, but we are looking at and ask for help from last year's bill about the standards and guidelines of HMOs, which have not been updated in decades. And that we need to address this because when they first came out in HMOs, there were no for-profit. So both need updating, and that was the purpose of the study that MDH did. They came out with their preliminary report, which came out in January 15th. It's available to all of you. I encourage you to read it. It's a short read. It's like 75 pages, but it is very good, and it sort of lays out the issues and looks to other states, too, to just see the best practices. So that's where this is coming from. We are adopting some of those best practices in an initial phase of this session, and that's what this bill reflects.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Bierman. I'm just wondering, since 2017, I'm not sure how many nonprofit HMOs we've had, but that's over 6 years ago, pushing seven since we allowed private HMOs to start in Minnesota. Are you aware of any nonprofit HMOs converting to private in Minnesota yet?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, there's been a conversion moratorium in Minnesota for these years. It's been renewed a couple times, and it presently is in play still. So it would have opened up last July had we not passed an extension of that. So we have kept the lid on that at this time. But there's other things to consider here in the complex world of healthcare and all of the entities that are involved, whether they're domiciled here in Minnesota or out of state. There's no real regulation or guidelines on that. They are complex enterprises with multiple for-profit and nonprofit portions, which at times they can transfer money from one to the next. And so we need to have better sight lines on what's going on there to protect the public interest, which has been building these HMOs all of these years with public dollars, public taxpayer dollars, and certain tax benefits.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Bierman. I know I've talked to a few of the different HMOs companies. And they are concerned that in the long run, a bill like this is actually going to increase health care costs because increased insurance premiums and stuff like that. So I do have concern on this, the way this is written right now. I think we need to look into it more before we go too far down the pipeline, as the insurance rates and stuff already in Minnesota are out of sight. Most people can't afford them. If they can't afford them, they cannot afford the deductibles that they have to pay, and I'm concerned it's going to make things go backwards and farther.
All right. Closing comments, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just closing comments, I share those concerns about the high cost of health care, and this is just one piece of that work that we all need to pay attention to and address. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All All right. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 4853 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next up, we've got Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg, I will move to refer House File 3410 to Ways and Means. And for the purposes of this committee, we're primarily looking at subdivision, Section 1, Subdivision 6. But Representative Freiberg, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you. Is the motion to Ways and Means or the General Register? My understanding is the costs were removed in the amendment in agriculture.
It's your bill, Representative Freiberg. Where would you like me to move it?
I believe we checked with House Fiscal and it was okay to go to the General
Register. All right. I will amend my motion that House File 3410 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you, Chair and members of the committee. This bipartisan bill was brought to me by the Animal Humane Society, Minnesota's largest nonprofit companion and animal welfare organization. The Humane Society operates three shelters in the Twin Cities area, including one in the district I represent. And I know that many people in this room, including me, have adopted pets from one of those shelters. We have shared the language of this bill with numerous stakeholders, including the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, which is neutral on the bill. This bill is simply about transparency. In Minnesota, kennels, shelters like the Animal Humane Society, and state-licensed commercial breeders are required to be licensed and inspected. Under current law, the inspection reports and other data for commercial breeders are classified as private under the Data Practices Act, so consumers cannot see the inspection reports even if they plan to purchase pets from a breeder. The same reports for kennels and shelters are already public data. People want to access information they can trust, whether they are choosing a restaurant hairstylist or a dog and cat breeder. There's a chart in the packets showing that inspection data for most state licensing boards in Minnesota are public, and most boards post the information online. My bill treats dog and cat breeders like other regulated businesses. With that, I'd like to have Kim LeBeau from the Animal Humane Society speak next.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and committee members. I am Kim LeBeau with Animal Humane Society. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Each year, Animal Humane Society adopts more than 12,000 pets from our three metro area shelters. And as an animal shelter, we are licensed and inspected by the Board of Animal Health. By law, licensing and inspection data for Animal Humane Society and all of Minnesota's nonprofit shelters and other regulated businesses is public data. In contrast, the same information on state-licensed dog and cat breeding businesses has been classified as private data. So as a result, I can find out more about my state-licensed hair salon than I can about the breeder who raised my puppy. This bill makes breeder data public and holds commercial breeders to the same transparency standard as nonprofit shelters, dog and cat dealers, and other regulated businesses. This applies to about 107 state-licensed commercial dog and cat breeders defined by law as breeders with 10 or more adult animals that produce 5 or more litters per year. It does not apply to smaller breeders who are not required to be licensed. And while Animal Humane Society encourages people to adopt, we also support responsible breeders, and this position has been stated on our website for the past 13 years. And as part of this position statement, we encourage people to do their research before spending thousands of dollars to ensure they're purchasing from a reputable breeder. This bill will allow people to do their homework so they know if a puppy was raised with 5 or 500 dogs, whether a breeder is a repeat offender, or if their license was revoked. So we urge you to pass this bill because it will ensure consumers have access to critical information before they make a significant financial and emotional investment in a pet. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion.
Yeah.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and to the testifier. My question is when someone adopts from one of your shelters. Is there information about that pet and how they were raised?
Any
Ms. Information? LeBeau.
Thank you, Chair. Any information related to the licensing and inspection process of Animal Humane Society as a shelter is public data.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, so I'm a little, yeah, well, that answer is not really answering my question. You want the breeders to give all this information about how the puppy, what kind of environment it was raised in, but you probably, the animal shelters don't know really when they get an animal, not all the time anyway, you're not always going to know what kind of environment your dogs or cats were raised in. Is that an accurate statement?
Ms. LeBeau.
Thank you for the question. So this bill is to really reveal kind of the data related to the inspection process run by the Board of Animal Health. So it will allow people to know how many animals a breeder has, so whether they have 800 dogs or if they have 50 dogs. Animal population data related to nonprofit shelters is also public data related to the inspection process. When we're inspected by the Board of Animal Health, the conditions in which the animals are housed are part of that inspection process. So they look at the conditions within the shelter, and we're graded just like a commercial breeder is, related to, is there adequate food, is there adequate water, et cetera. So those are the standards that would be, and that report would be public.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't know if this also answers your question, Representative Scott, but it's kind of in the nature of a shelter to not always know the exact background of an animal. I've adopted 4 cats from the Animal Humane Society over the last 15 years or so. And, you know, I knew going in, like, we found, they would say, we found this cat out, you know, outside when it was approximately 1 year old based on the condition of its teeth. So that's, you know, not something that's always possible to be known even. All this bill does is require that the same information about the number of animals that's currently known for shelters and kennels be available to the public for breeders as well.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't it accurate that a person right now that's seeking to purchase a dog, and don't get me wrong here, we're on our third dog. I mean, I love dogs. Cats, eh.
I won't hold that against the Representative
Don't
Scott.
Worry, I'm a dog person, oh, Representative Scott.
See, on the
don't
chair.
Get started with Representative Moeller, though.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's already available that these inspections are done, and it's on the it's for the public's consumption whether or not that breeder is in good standing with the folks that did the inspection, the Board of Animal Health. It's already stated that they're in good standing. If the inspection went horribly wrong, that's not what it would say. It would say, you know, this breeder is not in good standing. Is that an accurate statement to either the testifier or the author?
Ms. LeBeau.
So we do have summary data from the Board of Animal Health's annual report that there were 47 violations recorded for animal breeders over the last 5 years. But the problem is we don't know what the nature of those violations were. And, you know, it would have to be pretty severe for the license to be revoked. So it's just making sure that there's the same level of transparency that we have for other licensed businesses or entities, where if you have a violation, that's public information as to what the nature of the violation was.
Representative Scott.
No further questions.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a good bill that just makes public information to various licensed entities consistent. So I would encourage members to support it. And thank you for your time.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 3410 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Jordan. All right, I will move to re-refer House File 3577 to Ways and Means. Representative Jordan, I understand you have an A4 amendment. Would you like me to move that as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, I move the A4 amendment. Can you tell us real briefly what the A4 does?
Yes, Madam Chair. This amendment is cleanup and further harmonizes this bill with other states that have existing and Canadian provinces that have passed similar laws. It also adds to the exemption list medical devices and drugs, pesticides and insecticides, and animal medicines, a big theme today, from the exempt materials. It also exempts newspapers with circulations of less than 20,000, and it edits the statewide recycling list, which includes specific collection requirements based on population to account for differences between the metro and greater Minnesota.
All right. Any discussion to the A4? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Jordan, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for moving my bill. House File 3577 is a bill to deal with our waste problem because we have one in Minnesota. And 40% of our waste comes from packaging. This percentage of our waste will continue to grow as we have more and more of an e-commerce economy. And currently, we, taxpayers and residents, are responsible for the cost of a product's end life and the packaging that surrounds it as we pay taxes to our local governments and fees to deal with our waste. And much of what actually could be recycled is put in a landfill or burned in incinerators. This is also a public health concern. Incinerating and landfilling packaging is terrible for our environment, our water, our soil, and our bodies. The average American consumes a credit card worth of plastic each week. Microplastics have been found in breast milk, cord blood, and placenta. There is runoff from these plastics into our water and soil from landfills, and it also gets into our lungs as we incinerate trash and breathe in the air that is all around us. And so this bill is the solution. We need to generate less waste and deal with what waste we produce more effectively. And this bill does both. There are goals on page 15 of your bill, and the idea behind this bill is that the producers of the packaging pay. This forms the Producer Responsibility Organization, or the PRO, and I'm just going to keep saying PRO because it's too early for me to keep saying Producer Responsibility Organization over and over again. A needs assessment determines the PRO's activities, and this is updated every 5 years. The needs assessment is generated by producers, waste haulers, environmental organizations, and the MPCA. The MPCA also holds the PRO and the needs, holds the PRO accountable for reaching the goals described in the needs assessment. And so there are two sections of this bill that are in the committee's purview. The bill has already been examined in the Environment Committee, the State Government Committee, and the Commerce Committee. Section 18, lines 33.19 to 33.24, is an anti-competitive conduct section. And then section 22, which is enforcement, which is lines 34.13 to 34.30, is the enforcement section. Both of these are standard boilerplate enforcement language from the MPCA consistent with other product stewardship laws on the books. And Madam Chair, that's the bill. And here to say more is Kirk Kadelka from the MPCA.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank Representative Jordan for championing this important bill that the MPCA supports, and we'll continue to work with her as it moves through the process. Collectively, Minnesota has a waste problem to the tune of 6.1 million tons per year, and that number is only expected to grow. Right now, we only recycle about 45% of it, which means over half of it is still going to a landfill or waste energy facilities. These have negative environmental, human health, and economic impacts. The impacts of the life cycle of the products we produce and dispose of are enormous. To illustrate the benefits of waste reduction, reuse, recycling, and composting, Minnesota saves the equivalent of 4.6 million metric tons of carbon dioxide due to these activities each year. That's roughly the annual emissions of 970,000 passenger vehicles. Reducing, reusing, and recycling waste reduces greenhouse gases, while landfilling increases them. There are also lost economic benefits. We throw away about 1 million tons of recyclable materials each year. That value of the material is estimated to be $143 million going into a landfill or burned up. New and expanded businesses could create over 15,000 jobs with those materials. We have a ways to go in order to achieve the goals set by you, the legislature, and the Waste Management Act. And this legislation provides Minnesota with a system and resources to reach those goals for waste packaging. The MPCA's 2022 Sustainable Materials and Solid Waste Policy Report to the legislature recommends the establishment of a product stewardship program for packaging, just like this bill. There's no need to wait for another report on it. The product stewardship model, which this legislation utilizes, is a public-private partnership that is used in many locations across the nation and for products in Minnesota. The private side of the equation comes from the form of a PRO, or product stewardship organization. On behalf of producers, they draft and implement a plan to prevent waste in the first place through waste reduction and reuse efforts, and then, if not possible, fund for a recycling stream to reclaim materials and properly manage them. The anti-competitive language in the bill is similar to provisions enacted by the legislature when passing the Battery Product Stewardship Bill in 1991, the Electronics Waste Product Stewardship Program in 2007, and the Paint Product Stewardship Program in 2013. Specific to the collection of waste and recyclables, as envisioned in this bill, similar language was given to local governments in 1989 for a collection of these materials. This is something the legislature has done over and over, and we have not heard of any complaints or problems stemming from these provisions in Minnesota. In addition, as mentioned, the enforcement authorities are things that are already implemented by the agency and are similar to what we've done in other areas. On the public side of that partnership, the MPCA is charged with the oversight of the PRO's plans through the approval and denial of the plan and setting other requirements based by criteria outlined in the bill by the legislature. In addition, the agency oversees the implementation of the statewide performance metrics for waste prevention, reuse, and recycling. It's why it's important the bill contains strong provisions to provide the oversight of the PRO on key issues such as the statewide performance requirements. Thank you, Chair and Committee, for your time.
Thank you. We do have a couple public testifiers signed up. I have Peter Glessing and Amber Backus. If Amber Backus is here, if you could come on up to one of these chairs so we're ready to go, that'd be great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Peter Glessing, and I'm the Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for Medical Alley. Medical Alley is still reviewing the scope of the amendment of the A4 amendment under lines 1.10 through 1.12 pertaining to the exemption for medical devices and drugs, given that it was posted about 9:45 a.m. yesterday. With that said, we believe this amendment is a significant step in the right direction toward addressing many of our concerns about access to life-saving medical devices and drugs that we've expressed in previous committees. We are grateful to Representative Jordan for incorporating this language into House File 3577. As we move forward, Medical Alley will be seeking clarity and alignment between this bill and its companion. We appreciate Representative Jordan's dialogue with Medical Alley to address our concerns. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do have pretty typical amendment deadlines in this committee, so moves fast around here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus of the United Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of the National Waste Recycling Association Minnesota Chapter and the member companies that have generated over 17,000 jobs and provide collection, sorting, recycling, and disposal of waste in Minnesota. NWRA Minnesota shares the goal of Representative Jordan to reduce waste and increase recycling. Our companies have been an integral part of Minnesota's nation-leading recycling rates, but under the bill will no longer have control over the recycling portion of their businesses. The bill empowers brand manufacturers through the producer responsibility organizations, which is a mouthful, or the PRO, to establish stewardship plans, and these plans decide how NWRA members would be reimbursed for providing recycling services, what the reimbursement rates would be, and the terms and conditions for the contract. And this can be done in an anti-competitive way, since Section 18 of the bill explicitly authorizes the PRO to engage in conduct making it, quote, immune from liability under state laws relating to antitrust, restraint of trade, and unfair trade practices, unquote, when planning and implementing collection and recycling systems. And I would like to just quickly respond to Mr. Kudelka's comments. While this has been the standard for other stewardship programs, those were newer industries, not developed ones, where this PRO is going to be having oversight. So needless to say, this gives NWRA members great heartburn. They want to be able to protect their existing businesses and relationships and be able to compete for new business and opportunities, not have the pro fence them out. Conversely, the bill makes recycling companies vulnerable to anti-competitive claims against them since there are no protections for the recycling companies or service providers, as they are referred to in the bill, who are required by law to implement the stewardship plans dictated by the pro. And this is highlighted on page 3 of the legal memo in your packet from NWRA Council. Lastly, the recycling companies have limited recourse to challenge the policies set forward by the pro, who is delegated powers akin to rulemaking authority without the due process protections afforded by the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. The need for adequate due process through rulemaking is especially acute here, since House File 3577 imposes $25,000 per day penalties for first-time violators of stewardship plans, as seen in Section 22B. We do have concerns about this non-delegation of authority to the pro, and we hope to continue working on these issues as our concerns about the pro's oversight have not been granted to date, and I thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Yep, come on up. If there's anybody else, now is your chance. All right. Welcome to the committee. As people who signed up ahead of time were told, they have 2 minutes, so you'll have 2 minutes, so please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for WM Waste Management. WM provides recycling services to communities, and we process recyclable material at our Twin Cities recycling facility. I'd like to comment on the antitrust issues and conflict of interest issues in this bill. The bill is only a framework for EPR. Many of the details will be delegated to non-elected officials, including the PRO, which is a select group of brand owners, an appointed advisory board, and the MPCA. Businesses in the PRO will collaborate with one another behind closed doors, making decisions that benefit some members at the expense of their competitors who are not members of the PRO. The PRO is an exclusive organization of big brand owners. Actions by the PRO, such as apportioning recycling system costs, are decided by this exclusive group, and then members and non-members of the PRO are assessed those fees. The advisory board is appointed by the MPCA, has two recyclers on it that will influence decisions affecting over 300 other recyclers in the state, including reimbursement rates for our services and where new recycling facilities will be built. These two recyclers could benefit financially from these decisions, posing a conflict of interest. Lastly, there's no legislative oversight for the actions by the MPCA, the PRO, or the advisory board. All four states that have passed EPR legislation include some involvement from the legislature during program development. In Colorado, they've run into controversy over the lack of transparency and the appearance of a few large brand owners that have hired a consulting firm to decide program details for them because of their fears with the legislation. These bills affect thousands of their competitors. In Maine, there's
Please wrap up.
I will. In Maine, there's controversy over the lack of transparency with the rulemaking process. Don't defer these rules and program decisions to a handful of brand owners in the PRO and my competitors on the advisory board. Thank you
for your testimony. All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jordan, I think there are a bunch of potential implementation legal issues with this. I think that the National Waste Recycling Association letter is pretty good on that. I was curious, though, if you could respond to the point specifically about the antitrust provisions. In their letter or in their memo, it says Section 18 immunizes pros from antitrust liability but provides no protection to producers and service providers who are required by law to implement the stewardship plans developed by the pros. And given sort of the overall structural problems that have been raised here where the pros and administrative rulemaking is really making a lot of the policy here outside of public view, I was wondering if you could respond to that point, are we opening up especially the service providers to some potential antitrust liability just by sort of following the results of the law that we're passing here?
Assistant Commissioner?
Chair and committee members, the Peter's practice has been establishing this authority for the product stewardship organization that is running the operation. So that's why it's focused on that piece. If there are other pieces that NWRA or others think are added, we'd be more than happy to look at that. But that's where the work and the collaboration is being done. Otherwise, other pieces with the service providers are contracts, just like they are set up right now between a waste hauler and the waste company and a local unit of government. Those relationships, the difference and the change there is sometimes it's who's paying the bill. There still be relationships between the city and the hauler. It's just that the PRO is going to be paying the bill, or instead of a direct relationship with the city, it will be with the PRO. Those one-on-one conversations with individuals are still the same way, although, you know, we're more than happy to look at other language to help with that issue if needed, if it's a suggestion.
Representative Niska.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Maybe there is some more work that needs to be done. That I guess I'm concerned that a lot of the work here is still to be done, and it's going to be done outside of the legislative process. And that's, you know, that's no way to make law in a democracy. The laws should be made here at the legislature, not down the road in some administrative rulemaking, or even worse, in a you know, private nonprofit entity where one sector of the economy gets together and gets to make the rules and impose it on another sector of the economy. So I don't think this is the right approach for a lot of reasons, but I do hope you can figure that antitrust piece out for sure. Thanks.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, I would just echo what Representative Niska was getting at, and Ms. Ketchum's testimony was very alarming. And I just think it's setting things up in an unfair manner. It's intervening in the marketplace and giving a few people on this pro organization, they are going to be self-interested. And they're competitors with the rest of the market, and here you are giving them the inside track. So I just think there's a lot of work left to be done in this. And Madam Chair, if we could have a roll call.
Sure. Anything further, Representative Scott?
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we can't allow, like, what our current system of waste management is not working. Our landfills are filling up, our incinerators are at capacity, and we're bearing both the actual costs and all the external costs associated with doing nothing. This is a bill that will make sure that we can have a waste management system that and increase recycling in a way that is responsive to markets, is responsive to the need, and can grow in a way that, you know, the legislature can't. I think it's interesting that there are members here who want to grow government instead of actually empowering those who are working in this sector to work with our government to make the laws that will allow them to do their jobs. But I think this is a good bill for members, and it's a really good bill for your taxpayers, too, who are currently bearing the costs of industry as they do nothing about their packaging. And so I'm very grateful for the support and look forward to talking about this more.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion to refer House File 3577 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Lead Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Pinky.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
8 ayes, 5 nays.
All right. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Next up, we have Representative Hewitt. All right, Representative Hewitt, I will move to recommend that House File 1718 be placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is a simple bill that took us a while to get here, but we're here, and it's a pathway for our railroad police officers to become Minnesota peace officers. For years, this has been worked on. Many stakeholders have been involved in this,
And here we are today. I think we're only here to address a few issues of the bill and move forward. With me, I have a representative from the railroads. If they're, if that's okay, I'd like to turn it over to her.
All right. Amber Backus, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now putting on my conductor's hat, as I am the representative for the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association and the four Class 1s and the regional and short line railroads that operate in Minnesota. We do appreciate Representative Hewitt bringing forward this bill. It's been 30 plus years in the making. It does establish a railroad police as licensed peace officers in the state under the authority of the Peace Officers and Standards or Post Board. And I think we're here because of Subdivision 9, the railroad liability provision. And we wanted to be sure that while these officers are going to be acting as any other law enforcement, the state is not on the hook for their actions. It would be the railroad companies themselves if something were to go awry. I just want to quickly point out that the Minnesota Association for Justice recently brought forward some issues with 3.28.3.29, and we're happy to strike that language, but we can do that at a later stop since we didn't have time to have an amendment prepared.
All right. I've also got Joel Carlson signed up. Yep. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And I want to say, since 2008, I have finally found something that Representative Scott and I agree on. I appreciate your comment on the cats.
On the record, even.
Madam Chair and members, the there are two spots in the bill that deal with immunities for these private employees that work for the railroad, and it is internally confused. And there is a immunity reference on page 2, line 17, and then the language that Ms. Backus mentioned on 3.28 and 3.29. If you leave that immunity language in there, the liability for the railroad is kind of meaningless because it is an absolute, well, it's a very high immunity standard, not only for the employee, but for the employer. And it makes the reference on 3.33 relative to employee indemnification from their employer meaningless. And so those just is a cleanup. We went till 1 o'clock in Senate Judiciary last night. We didn't get to it, but I think they're gonna take that language in the other body as well. And that makes the bill something that we, I think, can all support. Okay. Happy to answer questions.
Yeah, and it did sound like there is consensus on removing that section. It's my committee and I'm the chair, so I'm going to make an oral amendment. Just to be clear, are we talking about, can you give me the line numbers? Is it all of Subdivision 9?
No. Madam Chair and member, oh, excuse me. I'll wait to be called.
Yep. All right. Mr. Carlson or Ms. Backus.
Madam Chair, brief oral amendment on line 2.17. I would put and before powers and privileges and delete immunities. So it would say officer has all the powers and privileges of a licensed peace officer. And then on line 3.28.
Just hold on. Research, you got that? Okay, go ahead.
And then on 3.28, delete all of 3.28 after the footnote subject to the privileges, and delete line 3.29 up to law. So it would start a railroad company employee.
Got it. Mr. Hopkins, did you get that? All right. So Mr. Hopkins, if you can repeat that for the record, and then that will be my motion.
So Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would be page 2, line 17, delete the first comma and insert and delete the second comma and delete and immunities. On page 3, line 28, delete everything after liability. In page 3, line 29, delete everything before a railroad company.
That was also my understanding. So that is my motion for the oral amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Representative Scott.
Chair Beckerfin, and I understand this is your committee, but that's a pretty substantive oral amendment, and I just want that the record to reflect that, I agree with the bill. I'm not opposed to the bill, but we have a process around here, and you know, if things weren't moving so quickly unvetted, maybe we wouldn't be here of having to make this substantive change in committee. So that's all I have to say.
All right. When we can find agreement in committee, why not get it done? Didn't want to pass the buck to somebody else when things are going to the general register. So I think it's actually better for us to have this discussion out in the open here. So that's why I made that choice. Any discussion, further discussion to the oral amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Ma'am. Thank you for working on that. Any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We'll move on to member discussion to the underlying bill as amended. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Hoyt. I know in the past the bills always have had the number of hours a railroad employee could work with as a peace officer in Minnesota before getting their license. I don't see that in the bill right this time. I'm just wondering how long they would have to get their license before they could actually start in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, they have to follow the same pathway that you did when you were licensed. They would have to go through that. That was the biggest discussion on this whole bill, was they have to go through the same procedures, same hours, whatever it takes. So it's no different than what you had to work so hard to get through to.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative White. So in other words, they have to have their license before they can actually work as a peace officer in Minnesota.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, yes.
All right. Anything further, Representative Johnson?
Yes. Chair Beckerfin, Representative White. I'm glad we got that part of it figured out. I do still have concerns on this bill. It's my personal concerns, because this is the first time we're allowing a private entity in the state of Minnesota to be a licensed police department.
Yeah, we did fully discuss this issue in public safety. We did have a stop there previously. Any other discussion to the underlying bill? All right. Closing comments, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the oral amendment that cleaned it up to get it going. And we heard about this last night, so that was great that you did that for me. Thank you. Again, this has been here for years, longer than I've even been around, and I'm glad that we finally found some common ground. Representative Johnson, I hope that we can come back and visit this if there's problems in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 1718 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Representative Tabke, I think you came back. All right. Representative Tabke, I will move to refer House File 4104 to the Ways and Means Committee. Welcome to Judiciary. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Beckerfin and members, and thank you for your flexibility on getting me on the schedule. House File 4104 is a bill from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. There has been in DVS of reinterpretation of language, and that language reinterpretation will cause significant delays in when anyone wants to lease a vehicle. So it will cause between weeks and months of delays, and we need to share data in order to make sure that those leases are handled appropriately. And so that's what this data sharing does.
All right. I've got Scott Lambert signed up. Are you just here for questions?
Just here for questions.
Got it. Even better. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Moving on to member discussion. Member discussion to House File 4104. You told me it was boring, and you were right.
Happy to be boring.
Closing comments, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much for your support, everyone. I appreciate it.
All right. I will renew my motion to refer House of 4104 to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Member.
Representative Liebling. All right. I will move to recommend that House Bill 3443 be placed on the General Register. Whoever's alarm is going off, if you can. Okay. That was the alarm, for those of you who don't have Apple phones. That's the alarm when you've lost your phone and you're making it ding to try to find it. Usually I hear it somewhere in the car and I know I can head out, but that's what that was about. So I will move to recommend House Bill 3443 be placed on the General Register. We do have an A2 technical amendment. That I understand, Representative Liebling, if you can real quick.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It lines it up with the Senate, and it is truly a technical amendment.
All right. I will move the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. So I think you're probably all familiar with the Minnesota Health Records Act that's been around since 2007. That protects the privacy of patient medical records beyond the limited protections in federal law under the law we call HIPAA. And HIPAA specifically allows states to provide more stringent protections for our residents here in Minnesota. And that's what we have been doing as a legislature bipartisanly for quite a few years. Although the MHRA has been controversial at times, it's been amended over the years. But there has been solid bipartisan agreement that the medical records of Minnesotans should not be shared without consent. Unfortunately, in October of 2023, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the MHRA allows the sharing of medical records without consent for the purpose of fundraising. And I think we've distributed this case to you. It's Schneider versus Children's Healthcare. The court's decision in that case rests on statutory interpretation. So basically, the court didn't think we meant it and said that where the MHRA protects the disclosure of protected health information without, quote, specific authorization in law, that the legislature meant to include federal law, including HIPAA itself. So this interpretation essentially guts the MHRA. It essentially says that anything that is prohibited under the MHRA, just look to HIPAA. Well, the very purpose of the MHRA is to give more stringent protection than HIPAA. So what this bill does, it's a very simple bill. It simply clarifies our intent that the MHRA is stronger than HIPAA, and that where it says authorization law, we mean Minnesota law, not HIPAA. The bill does not change the MHRA. I just want to be really clear about that. It merely restores the law to what it was before the Schneider case. So we do acknowledge that members may have varying views about the MHRA, what it should cover, how it should apply. We've discussed these things over the years. I'm sure we'll continue to discuss it. The bill does not take any position on any of that. I think its legislators should be united and stopping the gutting of our bipartisan law that protects the medical privacy of Minnesotans. So I would ask for your support.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Chair Beckerfin, thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this really important clarifying bill. As if I really didn't get the court's ruling. It didn't seem to me that it needed much clarification, but we'll belt and suspenders it up. And thank you for bringing this bill and protecting the health records of Minnesotans. That's what we all need to be concerned about. Thanks.
Yep. Any further discussion? Representative Liebling, closing comments.
Thank you very much for hearing the bill.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 3443 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Next up, Representative Cleavorn. I will move to refer House Bill 4854 to the State and Local Government Policy and Finance Committee. And then I understand you do have an amendment. Do you want to take care of that first?
Yes, thank you. The A24.
All right. I've got the A24-0250 amendment. If you want to tell us briefly what that does.
Judge Sardi, this answers a question for your committee members, I believe.
Good. If you could introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm Jenny Starr. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And the amendment deletes lines 2.1 through 2.2, the phrase, and any other documents or data designated.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cleburne, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you. The courts include the Office of Administrative Hearings, the tax courts, and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. The proposed language brings important changes to the executive branch courts and the data practice laws that apply to their work into conformity with the judicial branch. One, they protect judicial work product. They protect they protect the judicial work product, they protect health records, and allowing the courts to refer to otherwise protected data or documents when necessary in writing their court orders. That's a basic high-level summary of the bill, and Chief Judge Starr is here with me, as well as General Counsel, if there are questions or concerns.
All right. Any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'm just wondering if Judge Starr could elaborate on the issues that you're facing that is behind this bill, why the need for it, because I want to get that on the record to be for sure.
Yep. Chief Judge Starr.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the first issue that the executive branch courts face is that our judicial work product is currently not protected under the data practices laws. And so what that means is when I'm hearing a case and I'm taking notes for myself, or when I'm revising a decision that I'm making, currently, if those notes are still in my file at the time of a data practices request, they would not be protected. In the judicial branch, for as long as I could ever know, that kind of internal thinking of a judge is properly and appropriately protected. The matter of public record is the decision, the order itself. With regard to health records, there are times in which a person offers their own health records into a matter. They're appropriately received by the court. Portions might be referred to in a judge's decision making, factual findings, or application of law, but largely those health records are not necessary, though they remain in the file. I hope that makes sense. What we're asking for here is, again, conformity with the judicial branch, so that if that file were to be asked for in a data practices request, the recipient would receive those factual findings that were appropriately necessary to understand the judge's decision, but not the totality of the medical records of that particular individual. And then the third portion is just clarifying that, in fact, judges, as they do today, can refer to not public data to the extent it's necessary for the public to understand the adjudicatory decision they've made.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
Madam Chair, just know I appreciate sitting down with the judge and understanding what their needs were, and I support this.
Yeah, glad you're advocating for yourselves. I think this is good policy as well. Closing comments, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Fenn and the committee, and I'd also like to thank Representative Scott for reaching out in advance. It makes it so much easier. It's a great bill. We ask for your support, and I would love a unanimous vote. Thank you.
I don't think anyone keeps that stat. Maybe you do.
Just maybe I do in my head.
I will renew my motion to refer House Bill 4854 as amended to the State and Local Government Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? You did it. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Motion prevails. All right. Do we got Representative Norris here? Yay. When people sit in the front row, I can't see through members to know if they're here. Representative Norris, welcome to the committee. I will move to recommend House Bill 4347 be placed on the general register. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. It's great to be with you. This bill does some cleanup on an important law that we passed last year related to coerced debt. 95% of abusive relationships involve some form of financial abuse. The law that we passed last year is designed to protect the survivors of this financial abuse while helping creditors attempt to recover the coerced debt from the perpetrator of the abuse. So coerced debt includes situations like the following. It might be, you know, an abuser stealing a survivor's identity and using it to incur debt. It could be forcing a survivor to take on debt through the threat of force, intimidation, undue influence, deception, coercion, fraud. Or it could be causing a survivor to go into debt by, for instance, prohibiting them from working. The victims in these situations may be victims of domestic abuse, harassment, or sex or labor trafficking. So this bill allows a survivor to seek equitable relief to either prohibit a creditor from holding or attempting to hold the debtor liable for the coerced debt, or dismissing any cause of action brought by a creditor to enforce or collect the coerced debt from the debtor. So this is the work that we did last year, and then this bill, you know, Mr. Elwood, as he does so excellently, has worked with the stakeholders to work through some of the other things that have come up since we passed this law, and I'll turn it over to him to talk a little bit more about what specifically is in the bill.
All right. Mr. Elwood, please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. We have, after the bill was passed, the Minnesota Bankers Association came forward and had some technical changes and a few substantive changes that would clarify what we were trying to do last year. We worked with them over the interim as well with the Minnesota Credit Union Network, which you have a letter in your packet of support from the MinCUN. And this bill takes care of a couple of the concerns that the Minnesota Bank Association had. I would specifically, I think one of the more important provisions is on lines 227 to 22 or 3.2, which clarifies that the debt that is relieved from the victim survivor can be transferred over to the abuser where it belongs. Happy to answer any questions. Appreciate your support.
All right. Are there other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Norris, I understand why this is needed, but I'm just curious. This bill doesn't take effect till January 1st of 2025. Normally, we something like this would be take first August 1st. I'm just wondering why you're waiting an extra 4 or 5 months.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, this is the request of the Bankers Association to allow them to prepare their members for some of the changes, and we acceded to their request.
Any further discussion? All right. Closing comments, Representative Norris.
Chair Becker-Finn and members, I just appreciate your continued support for supporting the survivors of this coerced debt situation.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 4347 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen. I will move to re-refer House File 44. I'm just thinking about animals. House File 4410 back to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an agency bill with a couple of small changes. So I do have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency staff here to walk through the bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank Chair Hansen for bringing this bill forward. It is an agency bill. As Chair Hansen mentioned, there have been some amendments, and I'll talk a little bit about those in a second, but largely this bill is brought forward by the agency and makes some clarifications regarding the agency's enforcement powers, and then also creates some new tools in our emergency powers section. So some examples of what we're looking at here on line 2.1, the committee will see the agency has the ability to already to adopt, reissue, modify, deny, reopen, et cetera, permits and also enforcement documents related to preventing and controlling water pollution, but we're adding that term reopen to create some clarity there. We're also creating some areas where we feel that there is already an intent in statute, but that's not clear in existing law. We are creating those sections, like in Section 6 and Section 9. This is clarifying that if an entity were to have been required to get a permit and failed to get that permit, they are still subject to those same requirements that would be in the permit that they failed to obtain. So just ensuring that there's no incentive for an entity not to get a permit over another entity that is complying with the law and obtaining their permit as required. And then the final section, Madam Chair, to just point out is this Section 10, Emergency Powers. And this is addressing the agency does already have emergency powers, but it requires that the agency approve imminent and substantial endangerment. And that is a very high bar that is very difficult to prove. And there are various situations that the agency has encountered where there is still acts of significant concern to the public health and environment that the agency would like to take more drastic action to ensure the public safety. And these are listed in subdivision 2, line 10.6 to the end of the bill. Really 10.8 to 10.12 is that those areas where we may exist this or exercise this additional authority would be only in cases of falsification of records, history of noncompliance with enforcement documents, chronic or substantial permit violations, or operating with or without a permit where there's evidence of danger to the health or welfare of the people of the state or evidence of environmental harm. So there are some additional actions that the agency can take under those very emergency situations, and we feel that those are appropriate for that type of evidence of additional harm to the state or its people. So would ask your support on the bill as total. I will note again there were some amendments to this language. You'll see most of them in the Environment Committee were technical changes that the agency supports. However, on lines 7.13 and then 7.18 to 7.19, you'll see the addition of here of or any person on 7.13. And then again, or any person on 7.18, 7.19. These would create the ability for any person to take action on behalf of the state. And we have some concerns with that language. There's already a federal process under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA. And that process already exists in federal law and is for any person, against any person. So there's already a process available for injured persons. So I ask your support of the bill, and happy to stand for questions.
All right, we do have one public testifier signed up, Tony Quillis. And then are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill?
morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is...
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you and the members for allowing me to make a couple of comments on House File 4410. Madam Chair, I want to come at this from a perspective of a permit holder, and it's statewide for all the permits that the Pollution Control Agency issues, including air, water, and hazardous waste. This won't affect only businesses in the state, but also cities and counties. The first section I'd like to draw your attention to is on 4.15, and it shows up again on 8.28, and it talks about negotiated agreements where the agency is able to go in on costs over $25,000 and start accumulating expenses for modeling, risk management, sampling, and monitoring. There is no appeal or no way for a permittee to recourse or challenge any of these expenses. And so I think, Madam Chair, that's going to lead to increased litigation, which is more time and cost to the agency as well as permittees. Second concern is also, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, allowing any individual to bring civil penalties against permittees. I think it also leads to confusion besides being covered in federal law if an individual as well as the Attorney General brings action against the permittee, how those damages would be divided up. Sections 2 and 4, Madam Chair, deal with increased ability of the agency to cease operations. I think those are duplicative because they are covered under the emergency powers of the agency under Section 10, where they have the ability to immediate discontinuance of abatement of pollution without notice and without hearing. And I don't know of any case where they've been denied of this authority. And then finally, Madam Chair, in Section 10, also in Subdivision 2, the noncompliance and chronic and substantial are very broad, and I think that they should be further defined because it leads into suspended and revoked permits for the agency. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the ability to make my comments on House File 410.
All right, thank you. Come on up. Please introduce yourself and proceed. And as the testifiers who signed up ahead of time, you'll be given 2 minutes.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joy Anderson, and I am an attorney at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I am testifying in favor of this bill, including the private right of action, and against the amendment that has proposed stripping out that private right of action. This bill is important because it clarifies MPCA's authority, and it ensures that MPCA is empowered when people are violating their permits, not just to talk sternly to them, but actually to shut them down until there is no threat to human health or permit violations. And it also provides a private right of action in the name of the state to enforce those violations. And it's important to keep both of those things in there. The worries about the broadness of this private right of action we do not believe are warranted. The penalties and damages, it's very clear if you look at the language, they only go to the state. There are no private damages to the person who brings the action. The penalties go to the state. If there's damages for the environmental harm that's caused, those go to the state. And there are no attorney's fees that are recoverable by the private person. So the only person that's going to bring an action under this is someone who is really motivated to stop pollution that's happening in their community. They don't get money. They don't get attorney's fees. There's nothing there. This makes that less broad than the private rights of action under 8.31 that we were talking about today, and even under the federal statutes that were referred to earlier by MPCA. And it is important, despite those federal rights of action, to have this state right of action because there are state permits that don't have these federal protections. We think it's really important to ensure that MPCA really clearly has this power to shut down operations that are polluting, and that private citizens, when MPCA can't get to everything, because MPCA can't, they have a limited amount of enforcement that they can do, private citizens should be able to say, this thing is right next to me. It's polluting on my property. I need to get it shut down until this is fixed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll move on to, we do have an amendment. Representative Niska, I believe it's your amendment. If you want to move the A5 and then tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do move the A5 amendment. I think that, you know, that it's pretty clear from the discussion that the issues we're talking about here are issues that are statewide issues. They're public enforcement issues, and it's important, I think, that that issues like this are enforced by actors that are politically accountable to the public of the state, and that means, in this case, the MPCA. I did appreciate the testimony from Mr. Johnson from the MPCA. And I would like to also refer back to a conversation we had about a similar public interest regulation issue last week in the social media enforcement bill. Representative Stevenson pointed out, again, I think a really important thing for us to think about in this context, that bad cases make bad law, and the experts at the MPCA have particularly the expertise and the flexibility to look at particular cases and how to bring that litigation in a way that's not going to create potentially bad rulings and adverse consequences. So I do think it's important that we vest this enforcement authority with the MPCA and with the Attorney General. This language follows the same model as the amendment I offered on the social media bill that was taken by this committee, and that Chair Becker Finn, you said we should make good amendments. So I'm trying to make another one here. So I think that this is reducing a more efficient way, a more effective way to enforce these provisions without a lot of stuff going into the court system that maybe can be handled in a better way by the MPCA or the Attorney General. So I urge members' support. Thanks.
Right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Niska. Although I appreciate your strong support of the Chevron deference for agencies, I have to oppose your amendment. I think it's important with, you know, as it was testified both by the agency and by one of the testifiers, this is similar to what we have in federal law, but Minnesotans should have that opportunity under Minnesota law. Just kind of simply why. So what the amendment does is takes that away, and I would oppose the amendment and ask for opposition.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? All right. Closing comments on your amendment, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and appreciate those comments, Representative Hansen. I will respectfully decline the invitation to explain the difference between Chevron deference and prosecutorial.
He's not even a lawyer.
I think it's a good amendment. I hope members will support it, and I request a roll call, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, roll call having been requested, Representative Niska renews his motion on the A5 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Minority Whip Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick. Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
Representative Frederick. 5 ayes, 7 nays.
Five ayes, seven nays. The motion does not prevail. Moving on to member discussion of the underlying bill. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and I just wanted to say thank you so much, Chair Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. I happen to represent the community that was heavily polluted by water gremlin, and we know that enforcement would have been key in preventing the damages that still continue in my community. So I truly appreciate your work on this, and it's much needed, and I know my community is looking for this, so thank you.
The community I used to represent as well, and I know there were some problems with not stopping the pollution sooner, and there was harm, definitely. So thanks for bringing that up. Further discussion to the Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I just had a question for the MPCA, just a clarifying question on the emergency power, or the the emergency powers, and can the MPCA, if you could clarify, if the authorities allowed in that section apply to paper violations, or would it be limited to emissions violations?
And I'll just say some of the testimony was to issues not before this committee that are more properly before the Environment Committee, but I will allow him to respond, but we're not going to continue. This is not precedent setting as far as going off topic. Director, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, I would say it depends. There are some paper violations that we would consider very serious in terms of record keeping, for example, for hazardous waste. There have been major violations of a facility that was required to keep records of their hazardous waste for an incinerator that they were operating, for example, that we considered a very serious violation, one of the largest enforcement cases the state has brought in recent years. However, if you're referring to the submission of a document that the agency has requested that is somehow late, no, we would not be using this emergency powers for that type of violation.
All right. Anything else, Representative Scott? All right. Closing comments, Representative Hansen.
And ask for your support.
All right. I will renew my motion to refer House Bill 4410 back to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Feist, we're going to use the 5 minutes we have.
Yeah.
Right, Representative Feist, would you like to move to re-refer House File 4822 to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, and if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and move the A2 amendment. This is my amendment. This just was quicker for me to do it. So the A2 amendment removes Section 1 of the bill. The underlying goal of the bill is to respond to the Tyler Supreme Court decision, and I did not believe that the first section of the bill was properly in this bill. It's kind of a separate discussion as to how things should be funded, and so that is the motion to remove the Section 1 of the bill. Any discussion? Representative Feist.
I agree.
any other discussion to the A2? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Feist, please tell us about your bill.
Great, thank you. This bill is in response, as you said, to the May 2023 unanimous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Tyler versus Hennepin County, which found that Minnesota's tax forfeiture laws were unconstitutional. Specifically, the Supreme Court found that the county's excess proceeds from the sale of tax forfeited land beyond the total delinquent property taxes, costs, and fees owed was a violation of the takings clause. And I believe I forgot a verb in that sentence, but it's the county's keeping of those excess proceeds was the violation of the takings clause. The bill before you is the result of extensive collaboration and dialogue among stakeholders, including the Association of Minnesota Counties, which convened counties across the state to evaluate the Tyler decision and identify solutions. Legal Aid, the Judiciary Branch, constitutional scholars, and the DNR, among others, have also been included in conversation and analysis. I would also like to recognize the extensive research and counsel of nonpartisan staff that they have committed to this complex challenge. House File 4822 does the following. It makes a public auction mandatory when a claim for surplus proceeds is filed in order to pay out any excess proceeds to the property owner. It also creates a process to ensure that excess proceeds on minerals are not retained in violation of the takings clause. The bill addresses the holding of Tyler while also keeping many aspects of the existing law that make Minnesota unique and responsive to property owners. Specifically, we have a long redemption period, a payment plan opportunities to extend the redemption window, and ample noticing periods. Note that we are working on some updates to the language in response to additional input. That includes making the notice, the claims notice and process more clear and friendly to the property owner, providing clarifying language around scenarios involving multiple claimants, and making some additional technical changes to just facilitate a smooth process for the counties and the homeowners. Due to the Supreme Court's holding in May of 2023, we must take steps to immediately reform our tax forfeiture laws. This bill represents a balanced approach to this directive that incorporates perspectives and expertise in the hard work of many stakeholders and legislative staff. If we are not able to reform our laws, we are perpetuating a broken system for property owners and adding fiscal liability to the state. The problem will only get more expensive as time passes. And I have an expert here to say a few words, and then we also have a minerals expert if there are questions on that portion of the bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. And I would like to get to the public testifiers before we recess. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Rogan. I'm the Assistant County Administrator for Resident Services. And in the spirit of being short, Representative Price did a great job of explaining the Tyler decision. On behalf of counties, I just want to clarify that right now the statutes are unconstitutional. We need the legislature to pass something so that we can continue to enforce Minnesota's laws in a constitutional way. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about Tyler or other questions.
All right. I've got Joe Henderson. Is that your person who's available if there are questions, or is that somebody else?
I'm sorry, who did you
Joe ask? Henderson.
That is someone else. That
All right.
I don't know.
I don't see that person here. All right. It was somebody from the DNR, so I assume it's something that can be discussed more fully in the Environment Committee. Did you need to testify?
We sought to testify, yes.
Oh, yep, when I say your name, you got to get up. All right, and then I've got Christina Martin on deck if you want to come on over. You can pull up a chair. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Joe Henderson. I am the director for the Lands and Minerals Division at the Minnesota DNR. The DNR did submit a letter outlining our concerns on this bill, but thank you for the opportunity to comment on the proposed bill. As mentioned earlier, the bill allows a landowner to file a claim alleging that the value of his or her property exceeds the delinquent taxes, special assessments, penalties, and interest and costs. The landowner may file the claim with the county auditor during the period of redemption. The county will then auction the property, and the landowner is entitled to the surplus proceeds of the auction. When the property is auctioned, the county transfers the mineral interest to the state of Minnesota. This provision is consistent with the requirements within the Minnesota Constitution, which requires the state to reserve mineral rights on all properties that it transfers. Under this bill, if a landowner alleges that the value of the mineral interest exceeds the delinquent taxes, special assessments, penalties, and interest and costs, the Department of Natural Resources must determine the value of the mineral interest and provide a payment to the landowner of any excess amount. The DNR has three major concerns with this bill. First, as written, the DNR commissioner must determine the value of the landowner's mineral rights if there's a claim for surplus proceeds. The claimant is not required to provide any data or proof of existence of valuable minerals for the assessment of the value. The DNR does not employ staff who work in the area of mineral evaluation. DNR would need to retain additional staff to do this work. It would take an additional attorneys, engineers, project managers, economic geologists, to manage this statewide requirement. Second, the bill seems to require an auction even for properties that have typically been withdrawn from sale. For example, under current law, tax forfeited lands with inside state parks, certain forfeited lands on meandering waters, and lands subject to mining permits are withdrawn from sale. The withdrawal from these parcels from sale is consistent with land uses and protects the conservation value of the lands around them. Third, because landowners could file claims challenging the DNR's mineral evaluation, the DNR estimates that we would need to reimburse the Minnesota Attorney General's office for about one attorney's billable hours per year. We must use the Attorney General's office to defend us. It also should be understood that when the DNR would pay claims relating to mineral rights, the funds to pay those claims would come from the general fund. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing the DNR's concerns.
Yep, and I encourage you to work on this before it's heard in the Environment Committee. Ms. Christina Martin, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Christina Martin. I am a senior attorney with Pacific Legal Foundation. PLF's a nonprofit public interest organization. I represented Geraldine Tyler with PLF at the U.S. Supreme Court. I argued the case, and that's the decision and ultimately is precipitating this bill. In Ms. Tyler's case, she owed $2,300 in property taxes, and after adding penalties, interest, and fees, her debt became about $15,000, and the property sold for $40,000. There was a $25,000 windfall. The Supreme Court said this was unconstitutional to take a windfall at the expense of a debtor like Ms. Tyler. Unfortunately, the House Bill 4822 will not fix this problem. It creates a loophole to the Supreme Court's decision in Tyler. Rather than treat Ms. Tyler just like any other type of debtor, the law would let the county debt collectors continue to take windfalls. It shifts the burden on the debt collector to return the surplus proceeds onto the property owner to proactively go forward before they've even lost their property and then say, yes, of course I want to be paid for the value of my property. That doesn't make sense, and Michigan adopted a similar bill in 2020, and the result has been overwhelmingly that people do not get their surplus proceeds. They make their claims too late. I'm representing four such individuals in a case out of Michigan that, like this, would have required them to claim surplus proceeds before there were any. And there's been a number of lawsuits filed across the state of Michigan. They've been riddled with lawsuits. And if this bill passes in this form, it too will attract lawsuits in Minnesota. And I would be happy to maybe get to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court with one of those cases. I just want to touch on a couple of things that are really important for you to understand.
I'll wrap it up. Do have your letter is in the packet.
Letter is in the packet. The vast majority of these people are not capable of figuring out the system as it is. And there's a lot of really difficult circumstances that lead to people losing their most valuable asset and their home. And so I would just encourage the committee to not just provide better notice, but to give people more time. And Ms. Martin, you really need to wrap up.
It's not fair to the other testifiers, so I cut off at 2 minutes to allow anyone to go further than
that.
So thank you for your testimony. With that, members, we're going to recess so we have time to discuss when we come back this evening. Members, if the bills that we didn't get to and 4822, if you can put things back in your folders to make it easier on staff and so you have those available this evening, that would be great. All right, with that, we're in recess. All right. I call this meeting back to order. I feel like it's one of those, like, last time on Judiciary Finance. we left off with Representative Feist's Bill 4822. So House Bill 4822, as amended, is before us, and we are about to start committee discussion. So we'll move on to member discussion of House Bill 4822. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Feist. I was, I thought the comments of the attorney from the Pacific Legal Foundation were pretty interesting and I think somewhat concerning to me. They obviously have quite a bit of expertise in this area looking at this issue in a lot of different states. And so I just was curious to what degree you've been able to engage with them or that they've been able to give you feedback. I did try to have a conversation with them afterwards, but haven't gotten a lot of substantive, and they didn't have a chance to give a lot of substantive suggestions here today. So I just was curious if you could talk about that.
Representative Feist.
Yep. We have had a good conversation, an email exchange, and they sent a very helpful memo that I've read half of. I think the question is, do we want a process that would be driven by a claim? Or is there a possibility of a workable solution that would allow that automatic refund of the excess tax proceeds or excess proceeds of the sale without that claims process? I do ultimately think, just based on the reading of Tyler, that under Nelson versus the City of New York, that having some type of claims process is not inherently an unconstitutional violation of the takings clause. But I also have had a lot of really good conversations with Legal Aid and the AARP. And I think, to the extent that we can make this as easy as possible for vulnerable homeowners, we want to do that, of course. And so I've had many very good conversations with nonpartisan staff and with the counties and with many, many stakeholders. And it's definitely clear that having a process that's driven by some type of claim is a much more straightforward option. And so if we're going to go with the claims-free process, we just need to take into account really complicated questions of, what if the homeowner has disappeared? How long would the county have to, hold on to that money before it would, default to the state and still be constitutional? There are just a lot of, practical questions. We've had really good conversations, and I expect those to continue.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Feist. That's good to hear. I think, a couple things in there that I think I want to emphasize, I hope that we're working towards. One is obviously it's very important that we do fix our statutory scheme so that we're not leaving our counties as targets to litigation going forward. And I do think it's really important. I haven't dug as deep into the case law as you have, I think, about whether we need a claims, whether a claims process is fine or whether we need some other process. But as much as we can do, I think, to not have a quick trip for for the property owners to have a takings problem, I think is good. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I guess, if we pass this out, what's the process? How do you foresee the process going forwards in terms of coming to something that's a final product?
Representative Feist.
So what we're trying to do with this really urgent, complicated undertaking is make sure that just like it's very open communication and conversations amongst all the stakeholders so that any decisions we make, we're making in tandem and ideally not wasting nonpartisan staff's time coming up with ideas and then backtracking. So the process has been complicated. But I think it's really important that we don't do what's easiest because it's expedient and that we really do take a really close look at the constitutional questions, the practical questions for the counties, and then just the philosophical questions of how do we protect the property rights of vulnerable homeowners. So I don't know if that quite answers your question. It's been a lot of conversations happening as quickly as possible.
I think, and you'll notice it's House Bill 4822, so I know it was introduced a little bit late. I know it's going to environment and then taxes. I will say, too, I've been fully nerding out on this one, too, and it is one of the more complicated legally of the bills we've discussed. So I talked to some stakeholders as well. I know there's desire to make sure we get this right. So I'm sure Representative Feist will keep working hard, as she always does. Representative Niska, anything else?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Beckerfin. I just wanted to say, it's really important that we do get it done and get it done right this legislative session, and I'm interested in helping out to the degree that is helpful to get it across the finish line. But I appreciate that this has come late. It does look to me like you are trying to, you did offer something in good faith to try to get to meet all those goals, and so I am interested in trying to help out to the degree that I can. So, thanks.
All right. Any further discussion? Closing comments, Representative Feist.
I think we covered it. I was hoping that we'd have more complicated constitutional debates, but but I guess I'm glad that we're all on the same page that we want to do this well and we want to do it quickly. So, Representative Niska, I wrote down that you're interested in helping out, so beware. I will be reaching out. So, thank you. Please support this bill as it moves to the next committee.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to start a different kind of nerd caucus, Representative Feist. Representative Feist renews her motion to refer House File 4822 as amended to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Feist. And thank you, Mr. Rogan, for coming back. next up, let's see. Representative Curran. Representative Curran, would you like to move to recommend House File 4276 be placed on the general register?
Yes, that is my motion. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Don't have any amendments, and I don't have any public testifiers signed up. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Somebody waved, and I didn't know if he was waving because he wanted to come up or not, but... not seeing any public testimony, we'll move on to the bill. Representative Curran, please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. As you can see, the language is pretty short here. House File 4276 simply directs the reviser to update outdated terminology in statute where spousal relationships are referenced.
All right, pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward.
committee discussion. Members, any discussion? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. Thank you, friend. This is nice.
And I'm grateful that you brought it.
Any further committee discussion? All right. Representative Curran, would you like to renew your motion that House File 4276 be placed on the General Register?
Thank you, Chair. That is my motion.
All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. I don't know if you beat Representative Tabke, though. He was really fast this morning. Representative Hollins. We're going to do House File 3830 first. I will move to recommend that House File 3830 be placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about House File 3830.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. House File 3830 is a very, very simple bill. It is simply striking the language that says a man and a woman can enter into a prenup, and it says two people instead, because as you all know, same-sex marriage is legal in the state of Minnesota as well as around the entire country, and therefore everybody gets to protect their assets in the way they want to for an antenuptial agreement, and I hope you can all support this.
All right. No testifiers signed up. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, we'll move on to member discussion. Members, any discussion to the bill? All right, this is an easy one. Representative Hollins, closing comments.
I was hoping that we could be even faster and beat Representative Curran, but I guess.
Maybe, I wasn't timing. I will renew my motion to recommend House File 3830 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I don't think this one's going to be as fast. I will move to recommend that House File 3567 be placed on the General Register, and I know that we have a DE, so I will also move the DE1, and then we've got an A3 to the DE1. Okay.
That's correct.
And Representative Hollins, my understanding is the DE, the A3 to the DE1 amendment to the amendment fixes cross-references. Is that accurate?
That is correct. Yep, it just there's a couple of cross-references in the final bill that it needs to amend.
All right. All those in favor of the A3 to the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. And now we're to the DE1 as amended. It's a DE, so it's I know it's cutting the bill from 58 pages to 14. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape that you would like. Representative Hollins, please tell us about House File 3567.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate that. Yeah, we are going to balance that very quick bill with a very long one, and I apologize ahead of time. As I mentioned before, Minnesota passed marriage equality into law in 2013, and as part of that created gender-neutral recognition for legally married couples across Minnesota's laws. The U.S. Supreme Court also held in Obergefell versus Hodges that laws barring marriage between two people of the same sex are unconstitutional. However, a decade later, the underlying law in Minnesota does not fully reflect these decisions, and that lack of recognition is harmful to parents and children in our state. Minnesota law does not define clear pathways to parentage for families who use forms of assisted reproduction, such as IVF, despite how common these practices have become in our state and country. Minnesota lacks clear and comprehensive statutory guidance related to surrogacy agreements and how to establish the parent-child relationship for children that result from surrogacy agreements. Also, as a result, many parents, such as unmarried LGBTQ plus parents, must go through an onerous second parent adoption process in order to become legal parents to their own children. The absence of clear, efficient pathways to parentage is harmful for families across Minnesota. The legal processes that are currently needed, such as second parent adoptions, are often lengthy, costly, and place undue stress on parents and children. The lack of clear parentage pathways also creates confusion and litigation, and children are left more vulnerable because they are securely attached to only one of their two parents under the law. And that means, this means that a parent may, for example, be unable to make emergency financial decisions for their child because he or she is not fully recognized as the child's parent. This bill comes out of recommendations from the 2017 Uniform Law Commission and tailors those recommendations to Minnesota statute. The Uniform Law Commission brought together a broad and expert stakeholder group, including family law attorneys, child protection officials, and public health experts, who worked in 2017 to create a best practices framework to establish parent-child relationships in state law. Since then, bills similar to HF 3567 have been passed in seven other states and are introduced in three others besides Minnesota. This bill, as amended, puts initial building blocks of the larger Parentage Act into place. And I've got, I'm going to walk through the bill in a very high-level sort of way because I understand that it's pretty dense and I want folks to have a good sense of what we're doing here. So the first section of the bill sets out the definitions. The second part of the bill addresses assisted reproduction without surrogacy. Section 2 states that a donor is not a parent. Section 4 says that an individual who consents to assisted reproduction by another individual with the intent to be a parent of the child conceived is then a parent to that child. Section 5 addresses how that consent process works. Sections 6 and 7 address dispute of parentage by a spouse, as well as the effect of a dissolution of marriage on parentage that is established. And the remaining sections describe what happens in related to parentage in several specific situations, like if there's a dispute in parentage by the spouse, a dissolution of marriage, an individual that had previously consented to be a parent and wishes to withdraw that consent before the IVF transfer takes place. The third part of the bill addresses gestational surrogacy agreements. Section 10 defines the parties that are eligible to enter into the agreement. Section 11 establishes requirements for gestational surrogacy agreements, including the process for creating them, the required content, and the parameters around payment. Section 12 addresses how a change in marital status affects the surrogacy agreement. Section 15 outlines how an agreement can be terminated. Section 16 establishes parentage under a gestational surrogacy agreement, and the remaining sections relate to the death of an intended parent, order of parentage, and enforceability of the surrogacy agreement. And then finally, the final section of the bill sets standards for the treatment of information about a donor. And we can certainly get into that, but in short, sections 22 through 25 name the type of information that a gamete bank or fertility clinic must collect from a donor, including identifying information and medical history, and what information is disclosed and to whom, what choices a donor has relating to that disclosure of information and related record keeping. So I have several testifiers who I would like to have testify. I was going to say invite up, but I don't really get to invite them up.
Good catch. And first up, I have Kat Roan, and then I have Claire Sorman on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kat Roan. I am the executive director for Outfront Minnesota, our state's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization. And thank you to the committee and to Representative Hollins for this discussion around the bill. Parentage and families are an important part of LGBTQ communities, as they are for all of our communities. And we believe strongly in having laws that reflect the breadth of our family experiences and all the pathways that folks take to reach parentage. This bill and the language in it are adapted from the Uniform Law Commission's Uniform Parentage Act. So these are coming from a national group of multi-party organizations, politicians, folks engaged in these communities who have looked at these very complex and important pieces of law and have made these recommendations that we're bringing forward into Minnesota statutes. And so we believe that these are strong pieces of language that are necessary for bringing Minnesota's laws into a post-same-sex marriage equality world. We consistently hear from LGBTQ individuals and families that there are challenges to establishing and recognizing parentage here within the state of Minnesota. And while that may seem trivial to folks whose parentage is recognized readily, for those individuals, that can cause a lot of concern for what might happen if they're traveling out of state or seeking medical care, or if there are issues that come up in their relationship. And so having these clear pathways and clear legally established guidance for this is deeply important to LGBTQ families. But this is not solely for LGBTQ families. It is for all families who might seek assisted reproduction, IVF, and other pathways to parentage. And it's crucial that here as a state, as we continue to update these laws, that we bring them into the best practice across the nation. This is one and an important step in making that process happen, and we look forward to continuing to working with you all and the stakeholders as we work to adopt more of the uniform law.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Claire Sorman, and then I have David Gapin. And if, when I call your name, if you want to come up and get ready to testify, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good evening, Madam Chair, committee. Thank you very much for hearing our testimony today on this important bill. My name is Claire Sorman, and I am the owner and program director of the Surrogacy Center. For the past 7 years, I have been helping to build families here in Minnesota and assisting intended parents in achieving their lifelong dreams of parenthood. There are two groups of folks we serve: hetero couples who have experienced infertility issues, and LGBTQ couples who need assistance in building their families as well. For our clients fighting infertility battles, most of them have gone through years of heartache, failed transfers, losses, and the associated grief that comes with not being able to carry a pregnancy. IVF helps these couples achieve their dreams, and gestational surrogacy opens the door for them to make the impossible possible. Our gestational carriers who are matched with these intended parents are carefully screened, altruistic women who become surrogates to help others who are unable to have children on their own. They all do this because they are passionate about helping people, and they are never, ever coerced into acting as a surrogate. Our agency, as well as every surrogacy agency that I am aware of in this country, adheres closely to the rigorous surrogacy guidelines set forth by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, or ASRM. In the years I've been working with these families, and for the 22 years that the Surrogacy Center has existed, I have had zero clients who have expressed regret or dismay about this process in any way, and we have also had never had any lawsuits or legal actions promulgated against us in all of those years. As a member of SEEDS, the National Ethical Organization overseeing best practices in surrogacy, the experience is the same. You may hear from anti-surrogacy groups that the process isolates and commoditizes women, which could not be further from the truth. They will cherry-pick data and give rare examples where folks have had negative experiences and try to paint a picture that this is the norm, which is ultimately driven by willful misinformation in order to disguise a particular agenda. Our mission is clear here: to build loving families in a safe, legally protected way. Here's just a couple of direct quotes from our clients, and then I'll wrap up. Some of our IPs, JP and PC. We have been trying to start a family for 4 years, but have unfortunately experienced several heartbreaking losses along the way, including our son at 19 weeks and our daughter at 29 weeks. We have so much love to give, and we are so excited to finally become parents. We are in awe of your generosity and so grateful for your willingness to give us the biggest gift we could ever hope to receive. And then from a GCLS, I will admit that in spite of using IVF to build my own family, I was ignorant to what surrogacy really involved. It's not some far-fetched celebrity status act. Surrogacy is a beautiful team effort between willing carriers and the entrusting, grateful, intended parents. When I realized surrogacy was on my heart, I knew I needed to find an agency that viewed surrogacy not as a business transaction, but as a safe, ethical, and meaningful journey. Knowing that my own family and my intended parents were legally protected by the all of the what-if scenarios and the uncertainty of what a pregnancy can yield gave me great peace of mind as we navigated the medical side of surrogacy.
Let's get a wrap up.
Yep. In conclusion, I'm glad that you guys are listening to this testimony today, and surrogacy isn't going away. We're going to continue to grow as a family building option. So we believe it's integral to protect all parties involved by codifying this into state law. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, I have David Gapin, and then I have Jason Adkins on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is David Gapin. I am an attorney in private practice. I practice in family law, and specifically I do a lot of just assisted reproductive technology work. I'm very much regretting not preparing a written statement now that I'm standing or sitting in front of you. However, I think it's important to think of where this bill came from. More than a year ago, a group of attorneys convened a work group and put this together. We have combined, I believe, over 100 years of experience. I myself have been in private practice for 20 years now. When I started in private practice, gestational surrogacy, surrogacy agreements were already happening. So I think it's important to note what this bill is and what it is not. What it is a codification of already existing law. We are not changing the law. The court back in 2007, 2008 already has held that surrogacy agreements are enforceable. They're not against public policy. Surrogacy is happening. I have represented hundreds of gestational carriers and intended parents. There's never been an issue with challenging parentage. I've never had a problem, never had it come back to bite me. It is going to continue to happen. And what this bill does is create a set of procedures and rules to create uniformity across the state. Right now, depending on what county you're in, there's different procedures for establishing parentage, a different method. And so it's county to county, judge by judge. And so this bill fixes that. It actually creates some additional procedural safeguards for what has to go into gestational carrier agreements that don't exist under current law in terms of representation, in terms of age, psychological evaluations. So these are all important safeguards. And the speakers against this bill, those are the people who are advocating a change in Minnesota law. That would be a difference in terms of restricting it or in terms of outlawing it. And with that, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Jason Adkins, and then I have Patience Griswold on deck. Ms. Griswold, if you're here, if you can go ahead and come on up so we're not wasting time in between waiting for people. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. I'm Jason Adkins, Executive Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. We're here today to testify in opposition to Representative Holland's bill and hope that instead the delete all amendment gets adopted, which embraces the recommendations of the Legislative Surrogacy Commission. Though we can certainly understand the natural desire to have a child, and the Catholic Church is about the last institution that can be accused of being against bringing more children into the world, we must consider in greater detail the effect of surrogacy arrangements on the parties involved and also the way in which surrogacy arrangements can have broader social consequences. And these concerns, certainly the church is not alone, and its concerns cannot be written off as mere religious objections. Beyond faith leaders, a diverse array of anti-poverty advocates, those concerned about human trafficking, bioethicists, scholars, and feminist leaders have all expressed reservations about surrogacy precisely because of some of those challenging stories that you can easily find with a Google search. Among those concerns, first, the emerging physical and psychological problems that surrogates and children born of surrogacy arrangements are being shown to have suffered because of hormone treatments, the severance of the gestational bond, and other factors, including the intentional decision to raise a child and bring a child into the world without being raised by one or the other of the mother or the father. Second, the business practices of surrogacy brokers in some states and around the world, some of which have been shown to treat women like chattel and foster human and reproductive trafficking. Third, the fact that surrogacy arrangements allow people with money and means to do an end run around the adoption process, which is the normal state-approved way in which people terminate parental rights, and which has extensive protections for parents, the birth mother, and the child. Again, the solution here is to recognize that there is no existing legal framework for surrogacy arrangements in Minnesota. So the question is, which one should we adopt? Our position is that the regulations in the Delete All Amendment that do not ban surrogacy, but only ban the for-profit commercial enterprise of surrogacy, are the ones that we should embrace. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right, thank you. I have Patience Griswold, and then I have Rebecca De La Hunt on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patience Griswold. I'm the engagement coordinator at Them Before Us. Under this bill, what makes someone the parent of a child is not the natural biological bond that exists between them, nor adoption, an arrangement that is designed with the child's best interest in mind and thus requires rigorous background checks and screening of the adults involved. Rather, it establishes parentage on the basis of intent. This change turns children into commodities to be awarded to adults with the money and means to acquire them. Furthermore, surrogacy creates a class of people who can be sold. A child who is genetically related to the woman who carries him cannot be exchanged for money. In commercial surrogacy arrangements, a child who is created with donor gametes and carried by a surrogate can be. Even when a child of surrogacy is raised by their genetic parents, they experience the trauma of maternal loss when they are separated from their birth mother. Mother-child bonding begins in utero. By the time a baby is born, she knows her mother's voice and smell and has been responding to her emotions. Studies show that maternal separation is a major physiological stressor for an infant, and even brief maternal deprivation can alter the structure of an infant's brain. We urge you to consider the perspectives of those who have been victimized by this industry. Brian, a child of surrogacy, wrote, "Babies are not commodities. Babies are human beings. How do you think it makes us feel to know that there was money exchanged for us?" Olivia, another child of surrogacy, put it this way, "I lived it as an abandonment. I feel as if I was abandoned by my birth mother." Additionally, research has found that 70% of donor-conceived adults believe that society should not encourage gamete donation, and 62% said that they found the commercial nature of gamete donation to be unethical. Children are people, not products to be commissioned, swapped, sold, or traded under contract. They deserve to have their rights protected. As one donor-conceived individual put it, third-party reproduction is not a new way to create families. It's a new way to rip them apart. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Rebecca De La Hunt. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Becker Finn and members, my name is Rebecca Delahunt, and I work as the Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. On December 6, 1865, the USA ratified the 13th Amendment, which banned slavery in the United States, yet the Minnesota legislature is considering a policy in 2024 to regulate the trade of children, opening the legal door to the buying and selling of children. How is it possible to wholeheartedly support the 13th Amendment of the United States but then try to legalize the selling of children to unrelated adults in 2024? In surrogacy, the gestational surrogate is impregnated with an embryo by IVF, either with gametes from intended parents, donors, or a combination. The gestational surrogate then delivers the child to intended parents. An intended parent could be biologically related or unrelated. Children are already facing significant mental health struggles and identity craving. What will happen when we create a sizable population of them who are cut off from their mother and or father? Children have a natural right to their biological mother and father. We all understand that people crave to know where they're from. It's why adopted children face what is often called the primal wound. They sense the loss of being cut off from their identity. But adoption is different than surrogacy because in adoption, the child was not created with the intention of separating him or her from parents. Adoption is legally set up to facilitate children's best interests. Surrogacy provides intended parents with a product that they are sometimes willing to pay for. One is focused on justice for children who cannot advocate for themselves. The other is a marketplace for adults to pay for potentially unrelated children. These children are the key stakeholder of this proposed policy, and yet they don't have a seat at this powerful table. Surrogacy creates two classes of people, those who can buy children and the women who are often doing this to meet a financial need. Exploiting women's bodies like this is wrong. How is the renting of wombs ethical or the trading of children any different than human trafficking? It's not, and it's why I'm asking you to vote no. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we do have a couple other pre-filed amendments. So we will move on to those next. First, we're going to do the A2 amendment. Representative Niska, I believe that's yours. If you want to move the A2 and then tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I move the A2 amendment. It is really a pretty narrowly tailored amendment, trying to make sure that the surrogacy that's permitted under this bill would stay within sort of the guidelines of what we heard from the testifier from the surrogacy center, and make sure that it doesn't ever get into a situation in which babies are being bought and sold. And in particular, there's some concerning language on page 7, line 29, saying that a surrogacy agreement may provide for payment of consideration. And so my amendment simply make sure that there's not any selling of babies happening by deleting that language about consideration and saying that a surrogacy agreement may provide only for payment of reasonable expenses. Again, like we heard from the testifiers, we don't want surrogacy to be commoditizing women. We don't want it to be a business transaction. That was what the testifier from the surrogacy center said was her experience. And so if that's the, you know, the experience we're going for, then we should be prohibiting the payment of consideration as part of the surrogacy agreement. So I urge members to adopt the amendment.
Right. Representative Hollins is the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm going to recommend that folks vote no on this amendment. While I do appreciate Representative Niska's approach to this, and especially the fact that it is narrowly tailored, what I will say is that the type of compensation that they're seeking to limit are entirely optional for agreements and part of law in a number of states, both red and blue. I mean, Vermont, Utah, Oklahoma, like this is a very normal piece of language in this sort of law. And allowing people to come to an agreement on what that compensation should look like is a part of I think what we would like to see. So I would encourage a no vote at this point. Thank you.
Further discussion to the AE2 amendment. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And just in support of the NISCA amendment, even the testifier from the Surrogacy Center did say that women are doing this for altruistic reasons. If you're doing it for altruistic reasons, that means you don't do it to make money. And so I've done a fair amount of research. I was on the Surrogacy Commission that met several years ago, and this is my file I dug up. And one of the things that I found, even from the UN, and I've got some comments here from places around the world, where they took up this subject, and they determined that it would be best if women were not paid over and above expenses. And because of the power imbalance that it creates, a lot of times it's poor women their womb is basically being purchased by someone with tremendous means in many cases. And so I just think that's a dangerous road to go down. And so I hope that you'll support the NISCA amendment. Thank you.
All right. Further discussion to the A2? Representative Niska, closing comments on the A2.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hollins. I think perhaps other states allow it. Other states have allowed a lot of really abhorrent things in the past, but we're talking about potentially arrangements that would allow for buying and selling of human beings. And I think we should, as a state of Minnesota, draw a clear line on that, and I think members should vote yes, and I'm Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
All right, roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
Chair Becker-Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Minority Leader Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Crossell.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
Five ayes, eight nays.
All right, with five ayes and eight nays, the motion the amendment is not adopted. Moving on to the A1 amendment, Representative Scott, I believe that's yours if you want to move it and tell us about the amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move the A1 amendment.
All right, please tell us about it.
So this amendment is just a redraft to the Representative Hollins's DE that was drafted back in, I think, 2019 originally after the Surrogacy Commission. Commission's work was complete. And just a little bit of information about what's contained in the amendment. This does not outlaw surrogacy. It allows for surrogacy, but it narrows it to a gestational surrogacy where the mother is not related to the child, but that one of the parents has to be providing one of the gametes for the child. So in the body of research that both the Surrogacy Commission looked at, and even just going back over and refreshing today and finding some new information, they find that There's a lot less chance of a child being trafficked if at least one of the parents is biologically connected to that child. So this bill requires that at least one of the parents is biologically connected to the child. It also requires that the surrogate and the intended parents all are residents of the United States. The last thing that I think anybody in this committee wants to do with all the human trafficking going on around the world right now is send a child outside the confines of our country to who knows what, where we've lost control of that child having the rights that we enjoy as Americans and being subject to we don't know what outside the walls of this country, the borders of this country. This bill, as Representative Niska's amendment, I know it failed, but this bill says that a woman that is the surrogate will receive compensation for reasonable expenses. And it requires that the surrogate be financially secure and not on public assistance. Again, we don't want women to be renting their wombs for this, and so I think that speaks for itself. This requires the surrogate mother to be provided with a list of the potential risks involved with all the drugs and different things that are administered, and allows the surrogate mother to choose her own physician. That's not articulated either way in this, and I feel like the mother should be able to. The best practice would be there for her to choose her own physician and not take the physician of the intended parents want her necessarily to take. The contract in this situation would be invalid and enforceable if there was a requirement in the surrogacy contract to require the surrogate to terminate the pregnancy or use selective reduction. The best practice we found in the Surrogacy Commission was the implantation of one embryo, which would eliminate the reduction issue if that were in law. It requires the intended parents to be married. We feel like that's just in the best interest of the child. It's a more stable environment to bring the child into. And that overall, the best interest of the child should be the deciding factor, the major factor in any of the law that we write here, and that's what this bill does. It requires surrogacy agencies and brokers to register as nonprofits and requires all surrogacy agencies to be licensed by the Department of Health. We heard this morning in committee, and I know you weren't here, Representative Hollins, but in committee this morning we heard about HMOs and setting up a framework. Right now they're nonprofit, and we heard bantied about lots of concerns about for-profit. And so I think in this situation, to get away from the child or the mother, the surrogate, to get away from the buying and selling, that to have these agencies set up as a nonprofit is the way to go. And again, it just prohibits traditional surrogacy arrangements where the mother would have a biological attachment to that child. So that's in a nutshell what it is. There's more than that, and I won't go on. But those are the high points, Madam Chair.
Okay, that was a large nutshell.
It was
several pages. Representative Hollins, comments on the A1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Scott. So the first minority lead Scott. First thing I want to say is thank you, minority lead Scott, for having conversations with me. And I know we were texting last night about this bill, and I do appreciate your willingness to have a conversation with me and try to go back and forth, because I think that is important. I'm going to recommend a no vote on this bill, or on this amendment. I apologize, on this amendment. As as noted, it is quite expansive, and there are a number of barriers to assisted reproduction that are included in there, and a number of things that I would just strongly oppose and I think are in opposition to good public policy. So I would recommend a no vote, and I hope the committee understands where I'm coming from. I can go into more detail if you want me to, but
at some point it would be good to discuss the underlying bill. So any other discussion to the A1 amendment? All right.
Chair, I'd like a roll call.
Yep. Okay. Roll call. Any closing comments, Representative Scott?
You know, the surrogacy commission met for, I don't know, it's a whole interim. I do know that because it seemed like I was down here a lot. But we really did delve into the issues, and we heard a lot of testimony on both sides, on every side of this issue, because we don't have a legal framework in the state of Minnesota for this. And I really feel like this amendment is the one that serves, it's not outlawing surrogacy, but it is putting into effect best practices to protect the child in the best interest of the child and to watch out for those surrogate mothers to make sure that they're not being exploited. So I'd ask for members' support.
All right, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Minority Lead Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
5 ayes, 8 nays.
All right. With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Now moving on to discussion of the amended language. Member discussion, any comments? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Let me get to my notes here just a second. I'm shifting gears here from...
If you'd like, I do have another person on the list if
yeah,
you want to follow.
Okay.
Please. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and Representative Hollins, for your bill. I just have one quick question, then I have a thought. We heard during the testimony that this bill that you're bringing isn't going to change the operationality of surrogacy as it currently exists in Minnesota. Is that correct? Is that what I heard?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, Representative Finke. That is my understanding. It's to bring uniformity to the laws across the entire state.
Yeah. Representative Finke, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that I understand what the stakes are in the actual bill that we're hearing, which is that we're updating our language and making sure that the legal statutory language that we have is what we need for what is already happening to continue to happen in a way that legally protects everybody who's participating. And I think that, earlier... we had these two small bills to just update the statutory language to include queer communities after we legalize same-sex marriage. That's the law, and updating the language to reflect the law shouldn't be controversial. Everybody knows that same-sex marriage is legal, and we should be able to acknowledge that that's the fact. And I feel like we're kind of having a separate conversation here as well, where we're sort of pretending that what is the law isn't the law, and that we can just imagine a way for entire communities to lose their rights just because we kind of would prefer it that way. Some people may not. But like what we're really doing is updating the law to reflect the reality that includes everyone who's already doing this. So it's really, I just want to reflect that every time there is an opportunity for us to be inclusive, we don't also have to try to imagine a world where we are completely erased. Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Hollins. I was disappointed you didn't take the Scott Amendment. That was actually a recommendation for the commission that actually worked on this for a long time. I'm also disappointed that because of that, And because we're allowing compensation, we're getting to the selling of babies. I was actually disappointed by one of the testifiers on the adoption, talking about adoption. Of all these members on this committee, I'm probably the only one that is adopted.
Representative Johnson, I'll just say I don't know that you are, so you might want to just be careful.
I am
but you might not want to assume things about your colleagues, that's all.
I said, I don't know if they are or not, but I know I am.
That's, yep, go ahead.
I've also, as a law enforcement officer, dealt with a number of kids who were adopted. And when they had problems, it was because the biological family got involved. The adopted parents are wonderful people. They are my parents. I have no idea who my biological parents are. I don't care if I know or not. But the adoptive parents adopted me and loved me like their own. So I had a little trouble during that testimony because it's not what I've seen, not what I've lived, not what I've observed in my work. We had an opportunity to make this bill a lot better, and we didn't. I'm disappointed in that. We had an opportunity to make sure that we're not into the baby selling business, but we didn't do that. So I'm going to have to vote no on this bill. And hopefully we can fix it to protect those innocent lives.
Thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be brief. Maybe we're just codifying what's happening right now outside of a legal code. To the degree that we're doing that and to the degree in which, some of these surrogacy agreements that are existing might be crossing the line into selling babies, I guess we don't know. But what I do know is that we're creating a legal framework for that business to happen in the state of Minnesota. That's wrong. We should be trying to figure out if that's happening and trying to figure out what we can do to stop it if it is happening, not including language in the Minnesota statute books that creates a framework and approves of it to happen. So I urge members to vote no.
Representative Feit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Hollins, for introducing this bill. I dipped my toe in this policy space, and it's really, really complicated and really important. And so I'm just grateful that you have brought this bill this far. I was going to say to the finish line, but this is not the finish line. There's many steps. I had met with Representative Scott when I was looking into these issues, and I'm glad to hear that even though we haven't come to like full agreement, I'm glad to know that you've been part of the process in developing this bill as well. And I know I had shared my notes from our conversation way back when. So I'm really grateful for this bill. I think it's important. I know Representative Scott, when we met, you said that was the Wild West, and that's a bad state for the law to be in on something so important. So I'm glad that we're bringing clarity to the law. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, the only input I've had on this bill really is just a text back and forth on last night with Representative Hollins over the section on regulating the donor banks, which I have not delved into. I don't know much about the regulatory framework. I do know that I was texting. I'm like, well, I think there ought to be something in place to prevent, the one doctor that had like 100 kids out there. And I don't know that there's anything in this bill that prevents that. Maybe Representative Hollins can point that out to me, but that to me is unethical and just downright gross. But to think about. Members, I guess I have a question for Representative Hollins. And that is, you know, the literature that's out there, the academic literature on this subject, really talks a lot about to get around this human trafficking threat, that one of the intended parents be biologically related to that child. And I'm wondering, do you have opposition to that stance? And if so, what might be your reasoning for that?
Representative Hollins. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, Representative Scott. I do have opposition to that stance, and not because of something around child trafficking. The opposition is that there are so many circumstances where people are using surrogacy because they are unable to conceive on their own, right? And so for us to say, like, you're barred from it unless one person can be biologically related to this, just seems like an arbitrary cutoff place for us to draw the line. Because I have met women who have had their entire reproductive organs removed from an accident and whose spouse has, like, you know, problems with fertility, and it's like you're saying that those people don't deserve to be able to be parents in that way. And I do find that problematic. You know, these are real world examples and real world people who have talked to me about this and who have come to my office saying that this was an issue for them. And I don't think that I can say, well, because maybe there would be child trafficking at some point in the future, you should not be able to have a surrogate in this situation. So, I mean, that is why I'm opposed to it. It's because of the real world examples that I have seen that people have brought to me that said that, you know, this just doesn't make sense.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say this about the Surrogacy Commission. We tried to follow best practices that are out there and follow the literature for the research that's been done in this area across not just the country, but across the world. And this is what they found. And from the party that claims to be the party of science and following the science and following the fact, you're in denial. I understand there are situations where, like you just described, but there are also situations where two people that are unrelated to that child have a baby. And if you want the stories on this, I can provide those for you. From the time they receive that child, it is trafficked and it is sexually abused. And the one story that I've read, the child dies at age 6. Okay? This is what we're trying to prevent. And when you have a biological connection to a child like that, it's a lot less likely that that's going to happen. So I hope that you'll dig into some of these issues. Because they're really important to the life of the child, the best interest of the child. Members, I think that we could spend a whole committee hearing on this subject. I've tried to lay out what the Surrogacy Commission found. This isn't outlawing surrogacy, Representative Finke, and it's not current law. Every single line of the A, the DE is underlined, and every single line of the underlying bill was underlined. It's all new language, and there are instances where we do not adopt the Uniform Law Commission standards, and I think this should be one of them. I request a roll call on the bill, and I encourage members to vote no.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, committee members. Same-sex couples and families who utilize assisted reproduction should have confidence that their parentage is recognized under Minnesota law. These changes will ease parentage concerns, particularly for families who have a child through assisted reproduction or for those who opt not to get married but still wish to have full parental recognition and rights. And these changes will ensure that Minnesota remains a leader in the adopting comprehensive and well-established policies to support children and families. This bill ensures that the diverse family compositions in Minnesota are fully recognized and reflected in law. It's an important and necessary first step towards advancing the larger Parentage Act goal of ensuring that Minnesota's parentage laws reflect the needs of all of our families in our state. Our state is big, it is beautiful, it is diverse, and all of those families deserve to be represented in our statutes. Thank you.
All right, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Yes.
Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
8 ayes, 5 nays.
Right, with 8 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is, sent, I had to remember what was going, sent to the GR as amended. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Next up, I think we've got Representative Pinto here. And I will move to refer House File 4387 to the back to Public Safety. Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. We don't have any testifiers signed up. Representative Pinto, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. And Madam Chair, there's a letter. It's true, no testifier. There's a letter that I think was posted electronically. I have hard copies of the letter, which could be distributed. I don't know that they need to exactly, though I have them. So, Madam Chair, if you'd like to have a page do that, we can, or folks.
Why don't you tell us about the bill and we'll see if we need it.
Fair enough. Well, I guess that's a good, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair and members, House File 4387 was driven by a friend of mine who had challenges in obtaining an order for protection against a partner that had been very abusive. And that kind of uncovered a number of gaps and discrepancies in the process of serving orders for protection and more broadly protective orders, and even in dealing when they get dismissed and making sure that there's proper notice, et cetera. Much of the bill contains a series of reforms to make that process work more effectively. Also in Section 9 of the bill on page 7 is a task force that's established to work on a particular issue also relating to orders of protection and domestic violence convictions, which is that in many of those cases, the person, the respondent in the order, the defendant in the crime, the person convicted, is required to not have firearms. And yet, there's been a lot of information indicating that process does not work very well. We want to make sure that it works much better. And so the task force is focused on that process to improve how we can have that surrender of firearms and also how we can have our first responders be safer when they are responding to domestic violence situations, which is another real concern. So that is the bill, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your consideration.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We'll move on to member discussion. All right. Seeing no member discussion, I will renew my motion to refer House File 4387 back to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Chair. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, members.
All right, Representative Mueller. And I will note, members, House File 4569, which was the Howard bill that was on our agenda today, is being amended and removing the section, which was the reason it was coming to us in the first place. So we will no longer be hearing that bill today. Representative Mueller, would you like to move to recommend that House File 3204 be placed on the General Register?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. And then would you also like to move the A2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. The A2 amendment is before us, and I understand you have an oral amendment to the A2.
I think the A3 is just a separate amendment to the bill. It's not to the A2.
Okay. I think I wasn't sure if we were getting that.
And we have a written one as well. Staff worked their magic today and
got it. Oh, that's what we handed out at the beginning. Okay. So the sheet of paper you guys got at the beginning when we reconvened is the A3 amendment, which is, just to be clear, Representative Mueller, the A3 is an amendment to the A2 amendment.
The A3 is just an amendment to the bill, not to the A2.
Got it. Okay. So we'll amend your motion to be to move the A3 amendment then.
Yes.
Got it.
All right. I think we need to move both amendments separately.
Okay. Sorry. My notes are not correct. which one would you like to move first?
We can do the A3. It's just a purely technical amendment.
All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller now moves the A2 amendment. Can you tell us about the A2?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A2 amendment, this bill has had a lot of stakeholder discussion and negotiation, and the A2 amendment is in response to some concerns that were articulated from legal aid, particularly the attorneys who handle domestic violence cases, and a letter that we had received from Violence Free Minnesota and Standpoint. And so we have addressed those concerns with the A2 amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is now in the shape you would like. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that has been in the making for quite some time. Family law issues are often complex and controversial, which is why it's rare for a major family law bill to make it through the legislature. And as I mentioned before, this bill has been in the making for a while. It's collaboration between the National Parents Organization, the Bar Association, and the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Sometimes these groups are on very different sides, but they got together to try to find common ground and improve the family court experience for all Minnesotans. They took a cautious approach with this bill, introducing substantially the same language last biennium and then introducing it this year, or last year, before attempting to move it this year. They received a lot of feedback in that process. I want to especially thank Legal Aid and their lobbyist Ron Elwood for devoting tremendous amount of time to the bill over the last few years, providing very valuable feedback to make the bill stronger and better. While drafting the bill, the proponents tried to keep a child-centered perspective and focus on eliminating situations where children are trapped in the middle of prolonged conflict between their parents. There are several pieces to this bill, and I'm glad to be joined tonight by Samantha Gemberling, who can provide more details.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Samantha Gemberling. I am a family law attorney, and I'm here tonight representing both the Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, the Minnesota chapter, and the Minnesota State Bar Association. So I know you have had a very long day already, so I'm going to try and move as swiftly through this as I can.
We appreciate that.
I am going to start at lines 1.6 to 1.12. This is a new addition to the statute. The rationale behind a public policy statement in this context is to make clear that the laws of the state are equally applicable to both parents, assuming that both are fit and properly able to care for the needs of the child. It also focuses on the needs of the child to benefit from a relationship with both of the child's parents and is designed to focus parents towards working together to meet the child's needs. Line 1.19 is a technical change. As I'm sure many members of this body is aware, we changed the terminology on parenting time and visitation. That happened quite some time ago. And this was just a place where there's an oversight where we need to add parenting time to the consideration in 257.025. On line 2.8 to 2.13, this is related to when people file for a divorce, custody, or parenting time action in court, they will sometimes seek a temporary hearing if they've been unable to resolve their issues in a cooperative manner. There's two changes in this proposed legislation to how temporary hearings work. Often both married and unmarried parents manage their own parenting cooperatively, and they're able to do that for some time before coming to the attention of the court. If a breakdown in the relationship occurs, which results in a change to what's historically happened, this proposed change to the statute ensures that what the child has historically experienced with their parents is fairly considered by the court. And we think that's a very important change to make. I'm going to move on to line 3.4 to 3.2. Courts will conduct an accelerated or emergency hearing for urgent matters, like one parent fearing that the child is going to be taken out of the state. There are other serious issues that require prompt attention but don't quite rise to the level of an emergency or accelerated hearing. These issues can be dealt with in a hearing for temporary order, but often there is a long delay to get into court. Just as a sidebar off my notes, I was sharing with Mr. Lake, I was trying to schedule a hearing today in the Hennepin County court system, and it took me 20 emails back and forth. That's just to get that hearing scheduled. So one of our goals is to shorten this delay in two specific areas. The first is where a spouse is being denied necessary financial support, and the second is where a parent has been unable to see their child. These are two situations that are commonly used by one party to exercise power and control over the other. Our aim is to allow the court to resolve these high conflict issues swiftly instead of letting them fester for a significant period of time that it can take to obtain a temporary hearing. Line 3.28 to 331, this is an attorney's fees issue related to non-payment or other failure to comply with a court order. A parent can request an attorney's fee award if they can't afford to pay for a lawyer if they believe the other parent can afford to contribute. They can also request attorney's fees if another party has been unreasonably delaying the proceeding or made it difficult or expensive needlessly. However, the current statute doesn't apply in the time frame when you're trying to get another party post-decree, post-issuance of an order, to comply with an order, but you haven't yet filed a motion. For example, if you're owed payments that aren't being made, you have a duty to try to mediate that dispute first in your decree or court order oftentimes. And so during this period, the statute doesn't cover your attorney's fees and the money that you're spending trying to cooperatively obtain compliance with a duly noted court order. So this change to 518.14 addresses that concern, so one party can't intentionally delay the proceeding and not get any consequence that wouldn't be covered by the current statute. I'm going to move on to 5.23 to 5.25. The suggested change here is to address concerns that one parent or the other may be favored in custody litigation by moving this language, which already appears in the statute, to be included in a position where the court has to specifically consider it in making custody and parenting time decisions. We've decided in our work that it's just a more elevated place for the language to be, and we think that discussion is more preferable in that spot. 6.26 to 6.29, this is also a technical amendment to include parenting time, and also, as I just noted, to relocate that requirement that a parent shouldn't be favored based upon gender. Moving on to line 7.27, this change is to allow considerations for the court when weighing a modification of parenting time. These might seem like slight additions, but they're actually very important. To add both the mental health of the child and the safety of the child considers impacts that may arise from other types of conduct that parents could engage in that's detrimental to the child, but isn't as clear as a physical abuse type of endangerment. For example, in a case where a child is resistant to seeing a parent or refusing to see a parent, refusing time with them, the court may consider what we lawyers call the in parent, the parent who's currently favored by the child, to determine if they're perhaps engaging in some conduct that might be negatively impacting the child's mental health. If they are, more colloquial term, if they're sandpapering the child against the other parent, obviously that could be an issue that we want the court to be able to consider. There's been a lot of social discussion about parental alienation, and this is to address that type of behavior or concerning pieces that might need to be addressed for children's mental health. The safety addition is there to address circumstances where a child might be in an unsafe situation, but they haven't suffered any harm. And that's to address a concern that we don't want to wait for a situation to be escalated to an injury or some actual harm to the child before the court has authority to act. Line 8.4 to 8.6. These are changes to remove references to visitation, which is antiquated under our law, and also to address school breaks, which, if any of you parents know, they're not holidays, but they need to be addressed comprehensively in a parenting time schedule, and that can produce more challenge than you might imagine. 8.12 to 8.14, that change is a significant one and was a big piece of work for us, and that's addressing the presumptive minimum parenting time. That's been extensively discussed in previous hearings before this body, so I won't go through it more. But essentially, what we want to address is the fact that this 25% is a floor. It's not a ceiling. So it's not, there's been discussion, constituents have raised concern that presumptive minimum time provision as it's currently drafted is not sufficiently clear in the law so that the court could read it as that's the most that a non-custodial would receive, and that's not the intention. So the words "at least," while it's again a small addition, are designed to address a pretty significant concern. There's also a shift in this language to make it a little bit more child-centered and shift it off what the parents' needs are and more to the child's needs. So finally, the longest section, but the shortest comment I have, is 8.21 to 11.13. This section clarifies the options that the court has to deal with violations of parenting time orders. That was a really significant concern of the National Parents Organization that we wanted to address. It addresses orders that are set or appointed by third-party neutrals as well. Many parties, to avoid court, will use a parenting consultant or someone else court-appointed, and we want to be sure that all of those orders carry the same weight as the court order, which they should. And it wants to be designed to discourage parents from withholding parenting time from the other parent, to clarify remedies and sanctions, and to strengthen the court's ability to deal with situations where parents repeatedly deprive the other parent of time with the child beyond what the court allows as far as a criminal sanction, which can be very difficult to obtain. So that is my comments. I appreciate the committee's time, and I'm certainly willing to answer any questions on the bill.
Yeah, and as you noted and Chair Moeller noted, it's significant that we're bringing this bill forward and talking about it, and so I wanted to make sure you had time to fully walk through what is in the bill. We do have a couple people signed up to testify. I have George Rerat and Molly Olson. Ms. Olson is here. You can go ahead and come up closer to the table so when it's your turn, you're ready. All right, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and members. My name is George Rerat. I'm the Acting Director of Advocacy for the Minnesota Shared Parenting Action Group. Minnesota Shared Parenting Action Group is the largest Minnesota-based the largest Minnesota-based support group for children and families focused on Minnesota family law and its impact on children's and families. We have over 12,000 members, many times that of what the National Parents Organization has here in the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota chapter leader for the National Parents Organization is in Florida. They aren't here in Minnesota. So when we talk about, you know, consultation, we are the group that should be discussed, these issues should be discussed with. We did have a group that was formed in 2019 after the last family law discussion. In 2019, we met with both the Bar Association and the AAML. We met with them in 2019 and in 2020. There were no agreements reached on issues that are addressed in this bill, HF 3402. None. Zero agreement. We have not been consulted at all by anybody, which I think is not really a best practice that we'd like to see from our House of Representatives. I do certainly respect Representative Kelly Moeller's dedication to family law issues. We have a lot of concerns regarding House File 3402. The citizens of Minnesota desire for well-considered, well-vetted, well-discussed legislation. HF 3402 does not meet any of those requirements.
And I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. If I could just have one more minute, I'd appreciate it.
Then I have to give everybody another minute, and all the testifiers were told ahead of time that they had 2 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The timer just went off.
I just heard Samantha Gerberling talk for much more than
That's different. That's the author testifier.
So I respectfully...
Sir, you got to let me finish talking. The author's testifier is allowed to walk through the bill. It's a different process. It's the same on either side. We had folks sign up, and we've allowed you to speak for 2 minutes, and I need you to wrap up.
Okay. I respectfully request that Representative Mueller withdraw HF 3402 for consideration by this committee, allowing for discussion and collaboration. Should the bill proceed, I would urge a vote of no. Many committee members and authors have been led to believe that HF 3402 reflects a consensus. That is not accurate.
All right. You're not wrapping up, sir.
You
just went ahead and took the extra minute that you asked for. So I have, this is how this works.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Molly Olson is next, and then Tim McCusker is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Molly K. Olson, the founder of the Center for Parental Responsibility. CPR mission, remove the obstacles that prevent both fit parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children after divorce and separation. For 25 years, I've advocated for family law reform as an unpaid citizen volunteer. I've participated in 6 collaboration task forces and presented 1 to 5 bills every single session for 25 years. I send all legislators these flyers on a regular basis, educating you on all of these issues. Despite this track record, I was unaware of this bill or its promoters until recently. I was never approached for my input, despite having worked in 2019 and early before COVID with this group on these issues, but we were not able, as George said, to reach resolution, but since then I have not been spoken to. While some issues in this bill do need attention, the devil is in the details. Too much verbiage is too vague to claim any positive improvement. Ambiguity creates conflict. This bill will do very little for very few parents going through big challenges in family court. I have 7 pages of specific concerns, including solutions that would make this bill better. 3 examples are, 1, the bill mandates a hearing remedy for denied parenting time, but the way this bill is written, one parent can still deny the other parent 26 days a month, and the deprived parent will not qualify for relief. Minimal enforceability. 2, the bill purports to get tougher on enforcing adherence to court-ordered parenting time. While this sounds good, it's not a new concept, yet it's still unclear what constitutes a protected, out-of-court, informal, real-time agreement in writing. 3, the bill includes benign technical changes 10 years long overdue. What is wrong with this process that simple changes take 10 years? Reason, from my experience, the divorce lawyer lobby is given primary control of all family law statutes, same as it being vested interest tobacco companies having first and final say on all smoking laws.
And I'll need you to wrap up.
So there are very things missing from the bill, technical changes, lingering oversights, and more positive impact changes. And it is my request that comprehensive amendments are needed to truly prioritize the benefits of fit parents and children. So far, I have no commitment from the author as of this afternoon to meet face-to-face to address these issues. I think it's better to have no bill than a flawed bill, and please vote no or table this bill until it can be improved.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Tim McCusker. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Tim McCusker. I'm a retired engineer. I want to just thank the chair and the committee members for allowing me to testify today on House File 3204 and to Representative Mueller. My name is Tim McCusker. I was an affected parent of these child custody laws in the past, and now my children are old enough to be subject to these same antiquated bills like this. In fact, the introductory public policy statement of this bill includes ensuring that each child has frequent and substantial contact with the child's parents. Unfortunately, the rest of this bill does little, if anything, to live up to the spirit of this statement. Let's consider a metaphorical example. This bill, with this proposed minimal 25% parenting time for non-custodial parents, is like a patching a leaky pipe with duct tape. Consider how much of the demographics of our society have evolved over the last 50 years. Today, most women are not only working, but also obtaining college degrees, challenging traditional gender roles of years past. In fact, the chair and nearly half of this committee are working women, and coincidentally, all members of the St. Paul City Council are working women. Despite this progress, our family court system has been painfully slow to adapt. Even within progressive circles like the Minnesota DFL Party, meaningful change has been oddly elusive over the past 50 plus years on this issue, and so we stay regressed in the past century. I've spent over two decades witnessing and testifying for a starting place in law of equal shared parenting, yet progress continues to be wholly insufficient. We continue to nibble around the edges, applying more duct tape like this instead of implementing meaningful reform like equal shared parenting. Will I be sitting here before you in another 20 plus years from now saying the same thing? Why not prioritize a model that fosters cooperation and equity and reduces or eliminates conflict from the start? Isn't it time to move beyond duct tape solutions and embrace equal shared parenting as a standard? Let's build a future where every child has the opportunity to thrive with the love and support of both equally involved parents. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other members wishing, members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We will move on to member discussion. All right. Chair Mueller. Closing comments.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I just want to say that this has been a long time in the making. As I mentioned before, this was introduced last biennium. It was also introduced last year to give people an opportunity to look at it and provide feedback. I did meet with that group today, and I have asked for them to submit their 7 pages to me in writing. I want to thank all of you who've signed on to this bill. This might be the bill that I've ever had the most Republican co-authors on, and so I really appreciate that, and also Representative Scott, really appreciate your leadership in this area over the years. So with that, Madam Chair, I hope members can support this bill.
Yep, and I will also note for the record that this has historically been, as you noted, a difficult topic. I know I personally have gotten more threatening emails and aggressive lobbying is, I guess, how I'm going to put that on this issue more than any other issue. And so I thank you for carrying the bill and working with Representative Scott. You know, sometimes the mark of a good compromise is that nobody's totally in love with the bill, but I think this is an important notable step. So with that, Representative Mueller renews her motion to recommend that House File 3204 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Last bill, Representative Scott. Representative Scott, would you like to move to recommend that House Bill 2895 be placed on the general register?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair, and I do have an oral amendment. I think we got that, or is it a written one?
I think we've got the A1 amendment, and then you also have an oral amendment, is my understanding?
Okay, yes.
Okay. So the A1 amendment looks like it's just changing effective dates from 23 to 24. That's the A1. So would you like to move the A1?
I'll move the A1, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And then it's a good thing I'm allowing oral amendments today so we can clean up these bills. Representative Scott, if you want to tell us your motion with the oral amendment.
Right, with the oral amendments, Madam Chair, thank you. This bill regards spousal maintenance, and one of the changes that they're making is that they are changing language so that they're getting rid of language that is usually the language now is temporary,
and permanent, and we're changing that to transitional and indefinite. And so on line 2.3, the change would be to strike temporary and insert transitional. And then strike permanent and insert indefinite.
All right. I got that.
Perfect.
All right. All those in favor of Representative Scott's oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Scott, please tell us about your bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. This bill represents a pretty significant reform in spousal maintenance. The statutes have not been touched meaningfully for several years. And the main problem with our current statute is it gives insufficient guidance. As a result, parties don't know what the likely outcome of their case will be, and therefore they struggle to come up with their own agreements without resorting to litigation, which should, in my mind, always be the goal. The purpose of this bill is to give parties and courts better clarity, certainty, and predictability. We're aiming to achieve fair and equitable results while also preserving flexibility to deal with changing circumstances. And this includes addressing the issue of retirement, which has really never been brought to bear on this area of law. Discussions about this legislation began back in 2016, and it's been carefully calibrated and developed. And Samantha Gimberling is back with us for round two, second bill here, and I will turn over to her further explanation.
All right. I will note I also clerked in Hennepin County Family Court, so it's like a blast from the past today with all these family law attorneys.
Family law lawyers.
Please introduce yourself again for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Samantha Gemberling. I'm a family law attorney, and I'm here tonight representing both the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers and the Minnesota State Bar Association. As Representative Scott has previously noted, we started working on spousal maintenance reform on a constituent request in 2016. This proposed statute was developed in consultation with many other parties and the Bar Association, Representative Scott, and Senator Westland, who is carrying the Senate companion. What drove these changes was a frustrating lack of consistency and predictability in spousal maintenance cases. Litigants face very different outcomes depending on which judge they're in front of, even when those judges are in the same courthouse. Because they can't predict outcomes, parties struggle to reach their own agreements and are often driven to litigate. With this bill, we're attempted to provide some clarity and direction for the courts and parties, allowing sufficient flexibility to account for the diverse circumstances that faces parties in every different maintenance case. We wanted to replace dated language and ideas and address change in circumstances that aren't currently in the statute, like retirement. So I will, again, quickly walk through the changes to the statute. 1.15 to 1.16. We struck out through appropriate employment for several reasons. It is not to imply that there shouldn't be a consideration of appropriate employment, but that consideration can be captured in all relevant circumstances. For parties with significant means, there may be enough assets to make maintenance unnecessary because people have enough money from those investments to obviate the need for maintenance. But parties at all wealth levels frequently litigate about what appropriate employment means. Courts and parties will be better off if they focus instead on the phrase immediately prior, all relevant circumstances, which could include employment if it's relevant to the situation. Employment will remain a factor under an analysis of all relevant circumstances. But we're just trying to remove it from being something that people have to fight about and litigate. Moving to 2.13 to 2.14, this is an important change because many couples use debt to fund their standard of living, and they live beyond their means. After a separation, maintaining the same lifestyle becomes really difficult, and it would be unfair to use a standard of living that the parties never could actually afford. Line 2.15 to 2.18, these changes are a modernization of the statute, retaining the consideration that one party may have given up opportunity to benefit the other party, but not limiting that to homemakers. It still allows the role of both spouses to be considered. 2.22 to 2.23, the change to add mental or chemical health of both spouses. This previously only focused on the spouse seeking maintenance, and it's more fair to look at the potential payor spouse as well.
line 3.2 to 3.24. How long maintenance will last is perhaps the key discussion in maintenance cases. Many other states address this with statutory durational guidelines like we're doing in this bill. This is the single biggest change to the framework of maintenance in this bill. This will increase clarity and predictability for parties, and that will reduce litigation. It's also important to note that the guidelines are not set in stone. They're rebuttable, so courts can go outside them for guidelines that don't fit a particular, if the guidelines don't fit a unique situation. Finally, the words meet the expectation. And I know, Madam Chair, you probably heard this often when you clerked. When you're talking about permanent maintenance, that implies that it is permanent and it will never end, and that is not correct. It's permanent until it's changed by subsequent court order. Similarly, temporary maintenance is really transitional maintenance designed to move a party from the recipient of maintenance to get ready to make a life transition, to enter the workforce or to increase their earnings. So people are, we're giving language that people can readily understand and understand how it's going to apply to them and to their life. 3.27 to 3.29. The goal of this provision is to resolve any ambiguous orders or agreements to clarify that the obligation to pay spousal maintenance does indeed and should terminate when you are no longer alive and when your spouse remarried. And you would think that is something that doesn't happen, but I have myself litigated someone who's remarried and said they should still be entitled to maintenance from their former spouse. 4.3 to 4.31, the modification statute. This presently exists in a different part of Chapter 518, namely 518.39. The goal is to move modification into the statute to make it clear what the requirements are to modify and to align all maintenance issues in one part of the statute. So while it looks like a pretty substantial change, it's really a move more than a change. There's a technical change at 5.3, the cohabitation statute, just to make clear that modification that I just mentioned that just refers back to 5B, which would be the modification standard. Probably the second most significant piece of this bill is the addition of Section 7 in retirement. That's at 5.24 to 6.16. The current statute doesn't say anything about how retirement should affect requests to modify maintenance. This means that a party approaching retirement age faces a lot of uncertainty. The bill provides parties and courts factors to consider and addresses certain occupations that have mandatory retirement ages like air traffic controllers. The bill sets an expectation that both parties are also expected to use their assets for living expenses during retirement, which will eliminate a lot of litigation about whether parties should be allowed to preserve assets for their heirs rather than living off their retirement that they saved for and that they were awarded in the divorce. So the retirement piece will be really impactful in practice and will allow people to not pay maintenance into their 80s and 90s is the goal. I did not make any comment on the form, but that's self-explanatory, I think, and I would not have any other comments unless anyone on the committee has questions. We appreciate the time.
All right. Yeah, thank you for the walkthrough. Again, this is a big deal to move this forward, and I appreciate you walking through it. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott, I feel like you and I are the ones who know the most about this topic already. So, Representative Scott, closing comments.
I would appreciate your support. I appreciate Ms. Kimberly being here and her work. And I know Victoria's up there too and Brian Lake. And this is, I think, an important move forward.
Absolutely. With that, Representative Scott renews her motion to place House File 2895 as amended on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is on its way to the General Register. With that, members, we are done for the evening. I want to thank staff, Sergeant's Office, the pages, both partisan and nonpartisan staff for sticking with us on these late nights. With that, we are adjourned.